Prologue. By Grace and Banners Fallen. Baird pressed the coin between his thumb and forefinger. It was thoroughly unnerving to feel the metal squish. He removed his thumb. The hard copper now clearly bore its print, reflecting the uncertain torchlight. He felt chilled, as if he'd spent an entire night in a cellar. His stomach growled. Again. The north wind picked up, making torches sputter. Baird sat with his back to a large rock near the center of the war camp. Hungry men muttered as they warmed their hands around fire pits. The rations had spoiled long ago. Other soldiers nearby began laying all of their metal, swords, armor clasps, mail, on the ground, like linen to be dried. Perhaps they hoped that when the sun rose it would change the material back to normal. Baird rolled the once coin into a ball between his fingers.
Light preservus, he thought. Light.
He dropped the ball to the grass, then reached over and picked up the stones he'd been working with.
I want to know what happened here, Karam, Lord Jared snapped.
Jared and his advisors stood nearby in front of a table draped with maps.
I want to know how they drew so close, and I want that bloody Dark Friend Aes Sedai Queen's head!
Jared pounded his fist down on the table. Once his eyes hadn't displayed such a crazed fervor. The pressure of it all, the lost rations, the strange things in the nights, was changing him. Behind Jared, the command tent lay in a heap. Jared's hair, grown long during their exile, blew free, face bathed in ragged torchlight. Bits of dead grass still clung to his coat from when he'd crawled out of the tent. Baffled servants picked at the iron tent spikes, which, like all metal in the camp, had become soft to the touch. The tent's mounting rings had stretched and snapped like warm wax. The night smelled wrong, of staleness, of rooms that hadn't been entered in years. The air of a forest clearing should not smell like ancient dust. Baird's stomach growled again. Light, but he would have liked to have something to eat. He set his attention on his work, slapping one of his stones down against the other. He held the stones as his old papal had taught him as a boy. The feeling of stone striking stone helped push away the hunger and coldness. At least something was still solid in this world. Lord Jared glanced at him, scowling. Baird was one of 10 men Jared had insisted guard him this night.
I will have Elaine's head, Karam,
Jared said, turning back to his captains.
This unnatural night is the work of her witches.
Her head,
Ares' skeptical voice came from the side.
And how precisely is someone going to bring you her head?
Lord Jared turned, as did the others around the torchlit table. Ares stared at the sky. On his shoulder, he wore the mark of the golden boar charging before a red spear. It was the mark of Lord Jared's personal guard, but Ares' voice bore little respect.
What's he going to use to cut that head free, Jared? His teeth?
The camp stilled at the horribly insubordinate line. Baird stopped his stones, hesitating. Yes, there had been talk about how unhinged Lord Jared had become. But this? Jared sputtered, face growing red with rage.
You dare use such a tone with me? One of my own guards?
Harry continued inspecting the cloud-filled sky.
You're docked 2 months' pay,
Jared snapped, but his voice trembled.
Stripped of rank and put on latrine duty until further notice. If you speak back to me again, I'll cut out your tongue.
Baird shivered in the cold wind. Ares was the best they had in what was left of their rebel army. The other guards shuffled, looking down. Ares looked toward the Lord and smiled. He didn't say a word, but somehow he didn't have to. Cut out his tongue? Every scrap of metal in the camp had gone soft as lard. Jared's own knife lay on the table, twisted and warped. It had stretched thin as he pulled it from his sheath. Jared's coat flapped, open. It had had silver buttons.
"Jared," Karam said. A young lord of a minor house loyal to Sarand, he had a lean face and large lips. "Do you really think this was the work of Aes Sedai? All of the metal in the camp?"
"Of course," Jared barked. "What else would it be? Don't tell me you believe those campfire tales. The last battle? Pah!"
He looked back at the table. Unrolled there, with pebbles waiting the corners, was a map of Andor. Baird turned back to his stones. Snap, snap, snap. Slate and granite. It had taken work to find suitable sections of each, but Papel had taught Baird to recognize all kinds of stone. The old man had felt betrayed when Baird's father had gone off and become a butcher in the city, instead of keeping to the family trade. Soft, smooth slate, bumpy, ridged granite. Yes, some things in the world were still solid. Some few things. These days you couldn't rely on much. Once immovable lords were now soft as, well, soft as metal. The sky churned with blackness, and brave men, men Baird had long looked up to, trembled and whimpered in the night.
"I'm worried, Jared," Davies said.
An older man, Lord Davies was as close as anyone was to being Jared's confidant.
"We haven't seen anyone in days. Not farmer, not queen's soldier. Something is happening. Something wrong."
"She cleared the people out," Jared snarled. "She's preparing to pounce."
"I think she's ignoring us, Jared," Karam said, looking at the sky.
Clouds still churned there. It seemed like months since Baird had seen a clear sky.
"Why would she bother? Our men are starving. The food continues to spoil. The signs—"
"She's trying to squeeze us," Jared said, eyes wide with fervor. "This is the work of the Aes Sedai."
Stillness came suddenly to the camp. Silence, save for Baird's stones. He'd never felt right as a butcher, but he'd found a home in his lord's guard. Cutting up cows or cutting up men, the two were strikingly similar. It bothered him how easily he'd shifted from one to the other. Snap, snap, snap. Airy turned. Jared eyed the guard suspiciously, as if ready to scream out harsher punishment. He wasn't always this bad, was he? Baird thought. He wanted the throne for his wife, but what lord wouldn't? It was hard to look past the name. Baird's family had followed the Sarand family with reverence for generations. Airy strode away from the command post.
"Where do you think you're going?"
Jared howled. Airy reached to his shoulder and ripped free the badge of the Sarand house guard. He tossed it aside and left the torchlight, heading into the night toward the winds from the north. Most men in the camp hadn't gone to sleep. They sat around fire pits, wanting to be near warmth and light. A few tried boiling cuts of grass, leaves, or strips of leather as something, anything, to eat. They stood up to watch Airy go.
"Deserter!"
Jared spat.
"After all we've been through, now he leaves? Just because things are difficult?"
"The men are starving, Jared," Davies repeated.
"I'm aware. Thank you so much for telling me about the problems with every bloody breath you have."
Jared wiped his brow with his trembling palm, then slammed it on his map.
"We'll have to strike one of the cities. There's no running from her. Not now that she knows where we are. Whitebridge. We'll take it and resupply. Her Aes Sedai must be weakened after the stunt they pulled tonight, otherwise she'd have attacked."
Baird squinted into the darkness. Other men were standing, lifting quarterstaffs or cudgels. Some went without weapons. They gathered sleeping rolls, hoisted packs of clothing to their shoulders. Then they began to trail out of the camp, their passage silent, like the movement of ghosts. No rattling of chainmail or buckles on armor. The metal was all gone, as if the soul had been stripped from it.
"Elaine doesn't dare move against us in strength," Jared said, perhaps convincing himself. "There must be strife in Camelin. All of those mercenaries you reported, Shiv. Riots, maybe. Elenia will be working against Elaine, of course. Whitebridge. Yes. Whitebridge will be perfect. We hold it, you see, and cut the nation in half. We recruit there, press the men in Western Andor to our banner, go to, what's the place called? The Two Rivers. We should find able hands there," Jared sniffed. "I hear they haven't seen a lord for decades. Give me 4 months and I'll have an army to be reckoned with. Enough that she won't dare strike at us with her witches."
Baird held his son up to the torchlight. The trick to creating a good spearhead was to start outward and work your way in. He'd drawn the proper shape with chalk on the slate, then had worked toward the center to finish the shape. From there, you turned from hitting to tapping, shaving off smaller bits. He'd finished one side earlier. This second half was almost done. He could almost hear his papal whispering to him, "We're of the stone, Baird, no matter what your father says. Deep down, we're of the stone." More soldiers left the camp. Strange how few of them spoke. Jared finally noticed. He stood up straight and grabbed one of the torches, holding it high.
"What are they doing? Hunting? We've seen no game in weeks. Setting snares, perhaps?"
Nobody replied.
"Maybe they've seen something," Jared muttered. "Or maybe they think they have. I'll stand no more talk of spirits or other foolery. The witches are creating apparitions to unnerve us. That's what it has to be."
Rustling came from nearby. Karam was digging in his fallen tent. He came up with a small bundle.
"Karam?"
Jared said. Karam glanced at Lord Jared, then lowered his eyes and began to tie a coin pouch at his waist. He stopped and laughed, then emptied it. The gold coins inside had melted into a single lump, like pig's ears in a jar. Karam pocketed this lump. He fished in the pouch and brought out a ring. The blood-red gemstone at the center was still good.
"Probably won't be enough to buy an apple these days," he muttered.
"I demand to know what you are doing," Jared snarled. "Is this your doing?"
He waved toward the departing soldiers.
"You are staging a mutiny, is that it?"
"This isn't my doing," Karam said, looking ashamed. "And it's not really yours, either. I'm sorry." Karam walked away from the torchlight. Baird found himself surprised. Lord Karam and Lord Jared had been friends from childhood. Lord Davies went next, running after Karam. Was he going to try to hold the younger man back? No. He fell into step beside Karam. They vanished into the darkness.
"I'll have you hunted down for this,"
Jared yelled after them, voice shrill, frantic.
"I will be consort to the Queen. No man will give you or any member of your houses shelter or succor for 10 generations.
Baird looked back at the stone in his hand. Only one step left, the smoothing. A good spearhead needed some smoothing to be dangerous. He brought out another piece of granite he'd picked up for the purpose and carefully began scraping it along the side of the slate.
"Seems I remember this better than I'd expected," he thought as Lord Jared continued to rant.
There was something powerful about crafting the spearhead. The simple act seemed to push back the gloom. There had been a shadow on Baird and the rest of the camp lately, as if he couldn't stand in the light no matter how he tried. He woke each morning feeling as if someone he'd loved had died the day before. It could crush you, that despair. But the act of creating something, anything, fought back. That was one way to challenge him. The one none of them spoke of. The one that they all knew was behind it no matter what Lord Jared said. Baird stood up. He'd want to do more smoothing later, but the spearhead actually looked good. He raised his wooden spear haft. The metal blade had fallen free when evil had struck the camp, and lash the new spearhead in place, just as his papal had taught him all those years ago. The other guards were looking at him.
"We'll need more of those," Moreyar said. "If you're willing."
Baird nodded.
"On our way out, we can stop by the hillside where I found the slate."
Jared finally stopped yelling, his eyes wide in the torchlight.
"No, you are my personal guard. You will not defy me."
Jared jumped for Baird, murder in his eyes, but Moreyar and Ross caught the lord from behind. Ross looked aghast at his own mutinous act. He didn't let go, though. Baird fished a few things out from beside his bedroll. After that, he nodded to the others, and they joined him. 8 of the Lord Jared's personal guard, dragging the sputtering lord himself through the remnants of the camp. They passed smoldering fires and fallen tents, abandoned by men who were trailing out into the darkness in greater numbers now, heading north, into the wind. At the edge of camp, Baird selected a nice, stout tree. He waved to the others, and they took the rope he'd fetched and tied Lord Jared to the tree. The man sputtered until Moreyar gagged him with a handkerchief. Baird stepped in close. He tucked a waterskin into the crook of Jared's arm.
"Don't struggle too much, or you'll drop that, my lord. You should be able to push the gag off. It doesn't look too tight. And angle the waterskin up to drink. Here, I'll take out the cork."
Jared stared thunder at Baird.
"It's not about you, my lord," Baird said. "You always treated my family well. But here, we can't have you following along and making life difficult. There's just something that we need to do, and you're stopping everyone from doing it. Maybe someone should have said something earlier. Well, that's dumb. Sometimes you let the meat hang too long and the entire haunch has to go."
He nodded to the others, who ran off to gather bedrolls. He pointed Ross toward the slate outcropping nearby and told him what to look for in good spearhead stone. Baird turned back to the struggling Lord Jared.
"This isn't witches, my lord. This isn't Elaine. I suppose I should call her the queen. Funny, thinking of a pretty young thing like that as queen. I'd rather have bounced her on my knee at an inn than bow to her. But Andor will need a ruler to follow the last battle. And it isn't your wife. I'm sorry."
Jared sagged in his bonds, the anger seeming to bleed from him. He was weeping now. Odd thing to see, that.
"I'll tell people we pass, if we pass any, where you are," Baird promised, "and that you probably have some jewels on you. They might come for you. They might."
He hesitated.
"You shouldn't have stood in the way. Everyone seems to know what is coming but you. The dragon is reborn. Old bonds are broken. Old oaths done away with. And I'll be hanged before I let Andor march to the last battle without me."
Baird left, walking into the night, raising his new spear onto his shoulder.
"I have an oath older than the one to your family, anyway. An oath the dragon himself couldn't undo."
It was an oath to the land. The stones were in his blood, and his blood in the stones of this Andor. Baird gathered the others, and they left for the north. Behind them, in the night, their lord whimpered, alone, as the ghosts began to move through camp. Talmonis tugged on Selfar's reins, making the horse dance and shake his head. The roan seemed eager. Perhaps Selfar sensed his master's anxious mood. The night air was thick with smoke. Smoke and screams. Talmonis marched the band alongside a road clogged with refugees, smudged with soot. They moved like the flotsam in a muddy river. The men of the band eyed the refugees with worry.
"Steady," Talmonis shouted to them. "We can't sprint all the way to Camelon. Steady."
He marched the men as quickly as he dared, nearly at a jog. Their armor clanked. Elaine had taken half of the band with her to the field of Merilor, including Estion and most of the cavalry. Perhaps she had anticipated needing to withdraw quickly. Well, Talmanis wouldn't have much use for cavalry in the streets, which were no doubt as clogged as this roadway. Selfar snorted and shook his head. They were close now. The city walls just ahead, black in the night, held in an angry light. It was as if the city were a fire pit.
By grace and banners fallen, Talmanis thought with a shiver.
Enormous clouds of smoke billowed over the city. This was bad. Far worse than when the Aiel had come for Kyrian. Talmanis finally gave Selfar his head. The roan galloped along the side of the road for a time, then Talmanis reluctantly forced his way across, ignoring pleas for help. Time he'd spent with Matt made him wish there were more he could offer these people. It was downright strange the effect Matrim Cawthon had on a person. Talmanis looked at common folk in a very different light now. Perhaps it was because he still didn't rightly know whether to think of Matt as a lord or not. On the other side of the road, he surveyed the burning city, waiting for his men to catch up. He could have mounted all of them. Though they weren't trained cavalry, every man in the band had a horse for long-distance travel. Tonight he didn't dare. With Trollocs and Murdrol lurking in the streets, Talmanis needed his men in immediate fighting shape. Crossbowmen marched with loaded weapons at the flanks of deep columns of pikemen. He would not leave his soldiers open to a Trolloc charge, no matter how urgent their mission. But if they lost those dragons...
Light illuminous, Talmanis thought.
The city seemed to be boiling with all that smoke churning above. Yet some parts of the inner city, rising high on the hill and visible over the walls, were not yet aflame. The palace wasn't on fire yet. Could the soldiers there be holding? No word had come from the queen, and from what Talmanis could see, no help had arrived for the city. The queen must still be unaware, and that was bad. Very, very bad. Ahead, Talmanis spotted Sandeep with some of the band's scouts. The slender man was trying to extricate himself from a group of refugees.
"Please, good master," one young woman was crying. "My child, my daughter, in the heights of the Northern March."
"I must reach my shop," a stout man bellowed. "My glasswares."
"My good people," Talmanis said, forcing his horse among them. "I should think that if you want us to help, you might wish to back away and allow us to reach the bloody city."
The refugees reluctantly pulled back, and Sandeep nodded to Talmanis in thanks. Tan-skinned and dark-haired, Sandeep was one of the band's commanders, and an accomplished hedge doctor. The affable man wore a grim expression today, however.
"Sandeep," Talmanis said, pointing. "There."
In the near distance, a large group of fighting men clustered, looking at the city.
"Mercenaries," Sandeep said with a grunt. "We've passed several batches of them. Not a one seemed inclined to lift a finger."
"We shall see about that," Talmanis said.
People still fluttered out through the city gates, coughing, clutching meager possessions, leading crying children. That flow would not soon slacken. Camelin was as full as an inn on market day. The ones lucky enough to be escaping would be only a small fraction compared to those still inside.
"Talmanis," Sandeep said quietly, "that city is going to turn into a death trap soon. There aren't enough ways out. If we let the band become pinned inside..."
"I know, but..."
At the gates, a wave of feeling surged through the refugees. It was almost a physical thing, a shudder. The screams grew more intense. Talmanis spun. Hulking figures moved in the shadows inside the gate.
"Light," Sandeep said. "What is it?"
"Trollocs," Talmanis said, turning Selfar. "Light. They're going to try to seize the gate. Stop the refugees."
There were five gates out of the city. If the Trollocs held all of them, this was already a slaughter. If the Trollocs could stop the frightened people from fleeing, it would grow far worse.
"Hurry the ranks," Talmanis yelled. "All men to the city gates."
He spurred Selfar into a gallop. The building would have been called an inn elsewhere, though Isom had never seen anyone inside except for the dull-eyed women who tended the few drab rooms and prepared tasteless meals. Visits here were never for comfort. He sat on a hard stool at a pine table so worn with age it had likely grayed long before Isom's birth. He refrained from touching the surface overly much, lest he come away with more splinters than an Aiel had spears. Isom's dented tin cup was filled with a dark liquid, though he wasn't drinking. He sat beside the wall, near enough the inn's single window to watch the dirt street outside, dimly lit in the evening by a few rusty lanterns hung outside buildings. Isom took care not to let his profile show through the smeared glass. He never looked directly out. It was always best not to attract attention in the town. That was the only name the place had, if it could be said to have a name at all. The sprawling ramshackle buildings had been thrown up and replaced countless times over 2,000 years. It actually resembled a good-sized town, if you squinted. Most of the buildings had been constructed by prisoners, often with little or no knowledge of the craft. They'd been supervised by men equally ignorant. A fair number of the houses seemed held up by those to either side of them. Sweat dribbled down the side of Isom's face as he covertly watched that street. Which one would come for him? In the distance, he could barely make out the profile of a mountain splitting the night sky. Metal rasped against metal somewhere in the town, like steel heartbeats. Figures moved on the street. Men, heavily cloaked and hooded, with faces hidden up to the eyes behind blood-red veils. Isom was careful not to let his eyes linger on them. Thunder rumbled. The slopes of that mountain were filled with odd lightning bolts that struck upward toward the ever-present gray clouds. Few humans knew of this town, not so far from the valley of Thakandar, with Shale Ghul itself looming above. Few knew rumors of its existence. Isom would not have minded being among the ignorant. Another of the men passed. Red veils. They kept them up always. Well, almost always. If you saw one lower his veil, it was time to kill him. Because if you didn't, he'd kill you. Most of the red-veiled men seemed to have no reason to be out beyond scowling at each other and perhaps kicking at the numerous stray dogs, slat-ribbed and feral, whenever one crossed their path. The few women who had left shelter scuttled along the edges of the street, eyes lowered. There were no children to be seen, and likely few to be found. The town was no place for children. Isom knew. He had grown from infancy here. One of the men passing on the street looked up at Isom's window and stopped. Isom went very still. The Samanasai, the eye blinders, had always been touchy and full of pride. No, touchy was too mild a term. They required no more than whim to take a knife to one of the talentless. Usually it was one of the servants who paid. Usually. The red-veiled man continued to regard him. Isom stilled his nerves and did not make a show of staring back. His summons here had been urgent, and one did not ignore such things if one wished to live. But still, if the man took one step toward the building, Isom would slip into Telaironriad, secure in the knowledge that not even one of the chosen could follow him from here. Abruptly, the Samanasai turned from the window. In a flash, he was moving away from the building, striding quickly. Isom felt some of his tension melt away, though it would never truly leave him. Not in this place. This place was not home, despite his childhood here. This place was death. Motion. Isom glanced toward the end of the street. Another tall man was walking toward him, in a black coat and cloak, his face exposed. Incredibly, the street was emptying as Samanasai darted off down other streets and alleys. So, it was Moradin. Isom had not been there to witness the Chosen's first visit to the town, but he had heard. The Samanasai had thought Moradin one of the talentless until he demonstrated differently. The constraints that held them did not hold him. The numbers of dead Samanasai varied with the telling, but the claim never dipped below a dozen. By the evidence of his eyes, Isom could believe it. When Moradin reached the inn, the street was empty save for the dogs, and Moradin walked right on past. Isom watched as closely as he dared. Moradin seemed uninterested in him, or the inn, which was where Isom had been instructed to wait. Perhaps the Chosen had other business, and Isom would be an afterthought. After Moradin passed, Isom finally took a sip of his dark drink. The locals just called it fire. It lived up to its name. It was supposedly related to some drink from the waste. Like everything else in the town, it was a corrupt version of the original. How long was Moradin going to make him wait? Isom didn't like being here. It reminded him too much of his childhood. A servant passed, a woman with a dress so frayed that it was practically rags, and dropped a plate onto the table. The two didn't exchange a word. Isom looked at his meal. Vegetables, peppers and onions mostly, sliced thin and boiled. He picked at one and took a taste, then sighed and pushed the meal aside. The vegetables were as bland as unseasoned millet porridge. There wasn't any meat. That was actually good. He didn't like to eat meat unless he'd seen it killed and slaughtered himself. That was a remnant of his childhood. If you hadn't seen it slaughtered yourself, you couldn't know. Not for certain. Up here, if you found meat, it could have been something that had been caught in the south, or maybe an animal that had been raised up here, a cow or a goat. Or it could be something else. People lost games up here and couldn't pay, then disappeared. And often the Samanasai who didn't breed true washed out of their training. Bodies vanished. Corpses rarely lasted long enough for burial. Burn this place, Isom thought, stomach unsettled. Burn it with... Someone entered the inn. He couldn't watch both approaches to the door from this direction, unfortunately. She was a pretty woman, dressed in black, trimmed with red. Isom didn't recognize her slim figure and delicate face. He was increasingly certain he could recognize all of the Chosen. He'd seen them often enough in the dream. They didn't know that, of course. They thought themselves masters of the place. And some of them were very skilled. He was equally skilled, and also exceptionally good at not being seen. Whoever this was, she was in disguise then. Why bother hiding herself here? Either way, she had to be the one who had summoned him. No woman walked the town with such an imperious expression, such self-assurance, as if she expected the rocks themselves to obey if told to jump. Isom went quietly down on one knee. That motion woke the ache inside his stomach from where he'd been wounded. He still hadn't recovered from the fight with the wolf. He felt a stirring inside of him. Luke hated Ibarra. Unusual. Luke tended to be the more accommodating one, Isom the hard one. Well, that was how he saw himself. Either way, on this particular wolf, they agreed. On one hand, Isom was thrilled. As a hunter, he'd rarely been presented with such a challenge as Ibarra. However, his hatred was deeper. He would kill Ibarra. Isom covered a grimace at the pain and bowed his head. The woman left him kneeling and took a seat at his table. She tapped a finger on the side of the tin cup for a few moments, staring at its contents, and did not speak. Isom remained still. Many of those fools who named themselves Dark Friends would squirm and writhe when another asserted power over them. Indeed, he admitted with reluctance, Luke would probably squirm just as much. Isom was a hunter. That was all he cared to be. When you were secure with what you were, there was no cause to resent being shown your place. Light, but the side of his belly did burn.
I want him dead, the woman said. Her voice was soft, yet intense.
Isom said nothing.
I want him gutted like an animal, his bowels spilled onto the ground, his blood a milk pan for ravens, his bones left to bleach, then gray, then crack in the heat of the sun. I want him dead, Hunter.
Althor.
Yes. You have failed in the past. Her voice was ice. He felt a chill. This one was hard, hard as Moradin. In his years of service, he had learned contempt for most of the Chosen. They bickered like children for all their power and supposed wisdom. This woman made him pause, and he wondered if he actually had spied on all of them. She seemed different.
Well, she asked, do you speak for your failures?
Each time one of the others has tasked me with this hunt, he said, another has come to pull me away and set me on some other task.
In truth, he'd rather have continued his hunt for the wolf. He would not disobey orders, not direct ones, from the Chosen. Other than Ibarra, one hunt was much the same to him as another. He would kill this dragon if he had to.
Such won't happen again, the Chosen said, still staring at his cup.
She hadn't looked at him, and she did not give him leave to stand, so he remained kneeling.
All others have renounced claim on you. Unless the Great Lord tells you otherwise, unless he summons you himself, you are to keep to this task. Kill Althor.
Motion outside the window caused Isom to glance to the side. The Chosen didn't look as a group of black-robed figures passed. The winds didn't cause the cloaks of these figures to stir. They were accompanied by carriages, an unusual sight in the town. The carriages moved slowly but still rocked and thumped on the uneven street. Isom didn't need to see into the carriage's curtained windows to know that 13 women rode inside, matching the number of Myrdral. None of the Saman Asai returned to the street. They tended to avoid processions like this. For obvious reasons, they had strong feelings about such things. The carriages passed. So, another had been caught. Isom would have assumed that the practice had ended once the taint was cleansed. Before he turned back to look at the floor, he caught sight of something more incongruous. A small, dirty face watching from the shadows of an alleyway across the street. Wide eyes, but a furtive posture. Morden's passing and the coming of the 13s had driven the Saman Asai off the street. Where they were not, the urchins could go in some safety. Maybe. Isom wanted to scream at the child to go, tell it to run, to risk crossing the blight. To die in the stomach of a worm was better than to live in this town and suffer what it did to you. Go, flee, die. The moment passed quickly, the urchin retreating to the shadows. Isom could remember being that child. He'd learned so many things then. How to find food that you could mostly trust and wouldn't vomit back up once you found out what was in it. How to fight with knives. How to avoid being seen or noticed. And how to kill a man, of course. Everyone who survived long enough in the town learned that particular lesson. The Chosen was still looking at his cup. It was her reflection she was looking at, Isom realized. What did she see there?
I will need help, Isom finally said. The dragon reborn has guards, and he is rarely in the dream.
Help has been arranged, she said softly. But you are to find him, Hunter. None of this playing as you did before, trying to draw him to you. Luce Theron will sense such a trap. Besides, he will not deviate from his cause now. Time is short.
She spoke of the disastrous operation in the Two Rivers.
Luke had been in charge then. What knew Isom of real towns, real people? Almost he felt a longing for those things, though he suspected that was really Luke's emotion. Isom was just a hunter. People held little interest for him beyond the best places for an arrow to enter so as to hit the heart. That Two Rivers operation, though, it stank like a carcass left to rot. He still didn't know. Had the point really been to lure Althor, or had it been to keep Isom away from important events? He knew his abilities fascinated the Chosen. He could do something that they could not. Oh, they could imitate the way he stepped into the dream, but they needed channeling, gateways, time. He was tired of being a pawn in their games. Just let him hunt. Stop changing the prey with each passing week. One did not say such things to the Chosen. He kept his objections to himself. Shadows darkened the doorway to the inn, and the serving woman disappeared into the back. That left the place completely empty, save for Isom and the Chosen.
"You may stand," she said.
Isom did, hastily, as two men stepped into the room. Tall, muscular, and red-veiled. They wore brown clothing like Aiel, but didn't carry spears or bows. These creatures killed with weapons far deadlier. Though he kept his face impassive, Isom felt a surge of emotion. A childhood of pain, hunger, and death. A lifetime of avoiding the gaze of men like these. He fought hard to keep himself from trembling as they strode to the table, moving with the grace of natural predators. The men dropped their veils and bared their teeth.
"Burn me."
Their teeth were filed. These had been turned. You could see it in their eyes. Eyes that weren't quite right, weren't quite human. Isom nearly left right then, stepping into the dream. He couldn't kill both of these men. He'd have been reduced to ash before he managed to take down one of them. He'd seen Saman Issai kill. They often did it just to explore new ways of using their powers. They didn't attack. Did they know this woman was chosen? Why then lower their veils? Saman Issai never lowered their veils except to kill, and only for the kills they were most eagerly anticipating.
"They will accompany you," the Chosen said. "You shall have a handful of the talentless as well to help deal with Althor's guards."
She turned to him, and for the first time she met his eyes. She seemed revolted, as if she were disgusted to need his aid.
"They will accompany you," she had said. "Not they will serve you."
Bloody son of a dog. This was going to be a hateful job.
Talmanis threw himself to the side, narrowly avoiding the Trolloc's axe. The ground trembled as the axe broke cobblestones. He ducked and rammed his blade through the creature's thigh. The thing had a bull's snout, and it threw back its head to bellow.
"Burn me, but you have horrid breath," Talmanis growled,
whipping his sword free and stepping back. The thing went down on one leg and Talmanis hacked off its weapon hand. Panting, Talmanis danced back as his two companions struck the Trolloc through the back with spears. You always wanted to fight Trollocs in a group. Well, you always wanted to fight anyone with a team on your side, but it was more important with Trollocs, considering their size and strength. Corpses lay like heaps of trash in the night. Talmanis had been forced to fire the city gate's guardhouses to give light. The half-dozen or so guards who had remained were now recruits in the band for the time being. Like a black tide, the Trollocs began to retreat from the gate. They'd overextended themselves in pushing for it. Or rather, being pushed for it. There had been a half-man with this crew. Talmanis lowered his hand to the wound in his side. It was wet. The guardhouse fires were burning low. He'd have to order a few of the shops set on fire. That risked letting the blaze spread, but the city was already lost. No sense in holding back now.
"Brint!" he yelled. Set that stable aflame.
Sandeep came up as Brint went running past with a torch.
They'll be back. Soon, probably.
Talmanis nodded. Now that the fighting was done, townspeople began to flood out of alleys and recesses, timidly making for the gate, and, presumably, safety.
We can't stay here and hold this gate, Sandeep said. The dragons... I know. How many men did we lose? I don't have a count yet. 100 at least. Light, Matt's going to have my hide when he hears about that.
Matt hated losing troops. There was a softness to the man equal to his genius. An odd but inspiring combination.
Send some scouts to watch the city roadways nearby for approaching shadow spawn. Heap some of those trolloc carcasses to make barriers. They'll work as well as anything else. You, soldier!
One of the wearied soldiers walking past froze. He wore the queen's colors.
My lord? We need to let people know this gate out of the city is safe. Is there a horn call that Andoran peasants would recognize? Something that would bring them here?
Peasants? The man said thoughtfully.
He didn't seem to like the word. They didn't use it often here in Andor.
Yes, the Queen's March.
Sandeep?
I'll set the Sundress to it, Talmanis, Sandeep said.
Good.
Talmanis knelt to clean his sword on a fallen Trolloc's shirt, his side aching. The wound wasn't bad. Not by normal terms. Just a nick, really. The shirt was so grimy he almost hesitated to wipe his weapon, but Trolloc blood was bad for a blade, so he swabbed down the sword. He stood up, ignoring the pain to his side, then walked toward the gate where he'd tied Selfar. He hadn't dared trust the horse against Shadow Spawn. He was a good gelding, but not borderland trained. None of the men questioned him as he climbed into the saddle and turned Selfar westward out of the city gate, toward those mercenaries he'd been watching earlier. Talmanis wasn't surprised to find that they'd moved closer to the city. Fighting drew warriors like fire drawing cold travelers on a winter night. They hadn't joined in the battle. As Talmanis rode up, he was greeted by a small group of the sellswords. 6 men with thick arms, and likely thick wits. They recognized him in the band. Matt was downright famous these days, and so was the band by association. They undoubtedly also noticed the Trolloc bloodstains on Talmanis's clothing and the bandage at his side. That wound had really begun to burn fiercely now. Talmanis reined in Selfar, then patiently patted at his saddlebags. I stowed some tobacco here somewhere.
Well?
One of the mercenaries asked. The leader was easy to pick out. He had the finest armor. A man often became leader of a band like this by staying alive. Talmanis fished his second-best pipe out of his saddlebag. Where was that tobacco? He never took the best pipe into battle. His father had called that bad luck. Ah, he thought, pulling out the tobacco pouch. He placed some in the bowl, then removed a lighting twig and leaned over to stick it into a torch held by a wary mercenary.
"We aren't going to fight unless paid,"
the leader said. He was a stout man, surprisingly clean, though he could have done with a beard trim. Talmanis lit his pipe, puffing smoke out. Behind him, the horns started blowing. The Queen's March turned out to be a catchy tune. The horns were accompanied by shouts, and Talmanis turned back. Trollocs on the main thoroughfare, a larger batch this time. Crossbowmen fell into ranks and began loosing at an order Talmanis couldn't hear.
"We're not,"
the headman began again.
"Do you know what this is?"
Talmanis asked softly around his pipe.
"This is the beginning of the end. This is the fall of nations and the unification of humankind.
This is the last battle, you bloody fool!"
The men shuffled uncomfortably.
Do you speak for the Queen?
The leader said, trying to salvage something.
I just want to see my men taken care of.
If you fight, Talmanis said, I'll promise you a great reward.
The man waited.
I promise you that you'll continue to draw breath, Talmanis said, taking another puff.
Is that a threat, Kyrianin?
Talmanis blew out smoke, then leaned down from his saddle, putting his face closer to the leader.
I killed a murdral tonight, Andorin, he said softly. It nicked me with a Thakandar blade, and the wound has gone black. It means I have a few hours at best before the blade's poison burns me from the inside out, and I die in the most agonizing way a man can. Therefore, friend, I suggest that you trust me when I tell you that I really have nothing to lose.
The man blinked.
You have two choices, Talmanis said, turning his horse and speaking loudly to the troop. You can fight like the rest of us and help this world see new days, and maybe you'll earn some coin in the end. I can't promise that. Your other option is to sit here, watch people be slaughtered, and tell yourselves that you don't work for free. If you're lucky, and the rest of us salvage this world without you, you'll draw breath long enough to be strung up by your cowardly necks.
Silence. Horns blew from the darkness behind. The chief sellsword looked toward his companions. They nodded in agreement.
Go help hold that gate, Talmanis said, turning his horse. I'll recruit the other mercenary bands to help.
Lyalwyn surveyed the multitude of camps, dotting the place known as the Field of Merilor. In the night, with those clouds overhead obscuring moon and stars, she could almost imagine that the cook fires were shipborne lanterns in a busy port at night. That was probably a sight she would never see again. Lyalwyn shipless was not a captain. She would never be one again. To wish otherwise was to defy the very nature of who she had become. Bale put a hand on her shoulder. Thick fingers, rough from many days of work. She reached up and rested her hand on his. It had been simple to slip through one of those gateways being made at Tarvalen. Bale knew his way around the city, though he had grumbled about being there. This place do set the hairs on my arms to points, he'd said. And I did wish to never walk these streets again. I did wish it. He'd come with her anyway. A good man, Bale Domon. As good as she'd found in these unfamiliar lands, despite moments of unsavory trading in his past. That was behind him. If he didn't understand the right way of things, he did try. This do be a sight, he said, scanning the quiet sea of lights. What you want to do now?
We find Nynaeve Almira, or Elaine Trakand.
Bale scratched at his bearded chin. He wore it after the Ilianer style, with the upper lip shaved. The hair on his head was of varying lengths. He'd stopped shaving a portion of his head, now that she had freed him. She'd done that so they could marry, of course. It was well. The shaven head would have drawn attention here. He'd done quite well as Sojin once certain issues had been resolved. In the end, however, she had to admit that Bale Domon was not meant to be Sojin. He was too rough-cut, and no tide would ever soften those sharp edges. That was how she wanted him, though she'd never say so out loud.
It do be late, Lyalwyn, he said. Perhaps we should wait until morning.
No. There was a quiet to the camps, true, but it was not the quiet of slumber. It was the quiet of ships, waiting for the right winds. She knew little of what was happening here. She hadn't dared open her mouth in Tarvalen to ask questions, lest her accent reveal her as Seanchan. A gathering of this size did not occur without dedicated planning. She was surprised at the immensity of it. She'd heard of the meeting here, one that most of the Aes Sedai had come to attend. This exceeded anything she'd anticipated. She started across the field, and Bale followed, both of them joining the group of Tarvalen servants they had been allowed to accompany, thanks to Bale's bribe. His methods did not please her, but she had been able to think of no other way. She tried not to think too much about his original contacts in Tar Valon. Well, if she was never to be on a ship again, then Bail would find no more opportunities for smuggling. That was a small comfort. "You're a ship's captain. That's all you know, all you want. And now, shipless." She shivered and clenched her hands into fists to keep from wrapping her arms around herself. To spend the rest of her days on these unchanging lands, never able to move at a pace brisker than what a horse could provide, never to smell the deep sea air, never to point her prow toward a horizon, hoist anchor, set sail, and simply... She shook herself. Find Nynaeve and Elaine. She might be shipless, but she would not let herself slip into the depths and drown. She set her course and started walking. Bail hunched down slightly, suspicious, and tried to watch all around them at once. He also glanced at her a few times, lips drawn to a line. She knew what that meant by now. "What is it?" she asked.
"Lylwyn, what do we be doing here?"
"I've told you. We need to find..."
"Yes, but why? What do you think you will do? They do be Aes Sedai."
"They showed me respect before."
"And so you do think they'll take us in?"
"Perhaps." She eyed him. "Speak it, Bail. You have something on your mind." He sighed.
"Why do we need to be taken in, Lylwyn? We could find ourselves a ship somewhere. In Arad Doman. Where there do be no Aes Sedai or Seanchan."
"I wouldn't run the kind of ship you prefer." He regarded her flatly.
"I do know how to run an honest business, Lylwyn. It would no be..."
She raised a hand, quieting him, then rested it on his shoulder. They stopped on the pathway. "I know, my love. I know. I'm speaking words to distract, to set us spinning in a current that goes nowhere."
"Why?"
That single word scratched at her like a splinter under a fingernail. Why? Why had she come all this way, traveling with Matrim Cawthon, putting herself dangerously near the Daughter of the Nine Moons? "My people live with a grave misconception of the world, Bail. In doing so, they create injustice."
"They did reject you, Lylwyn," he said softly. "You do no longer be one of them."
"I will always be one of them. My name was revoked, but not my blood."
"I do be sorry for the insult."
She nodded curtly. "I am still loyal to the Empress, may she live forever. But the Damani, they are the very foundation for her rule. They are the means by which she creates order, by which she holds the Empire together. And the Damani are a lie. Suldam could channel. The talent could be learned. Now, months after she had discovered the truth, her mind could not encompass all of the implications. Another might have been more interested in the political advantage. Another might have returned to Seanchan and used this to gain power. Almost, Lylwyn wished she had done that. Almost. But the pleas of the Suldam, growing to know those Aes Sedai who were nothing like what she'd been taught. Something had to be done. And yet in doing it, did she risk causing the entire empire to collapse? Her movements must be considered very, very carefully, like the last rounds of a game of shall. The two continued to follow the line of servants in the dark. One Aes Sedai or another often sent servants for something they'd left in the White Tower, so traveling back and forth was common, a good thing for Lylwyn. They passed the perimeter of the Aes Sedai camp without being challenged. She was surprised at the ease of it, until she spotted several men alongside the path. They were very easy to miss. Something about them blended into their surroundings, particularly in the darkness. She noticed them only when one moved, breaking off from the others to fall into step a short distance behind her and Bale. In seconds, it was obvious that he'd picked the two of them out. Perhaps it was the way they walked, the way they held themselves. They'd been careful to dress plainly, though Bale's beard would mark him as Ilioner. Lyalwyn stopped, laying a hand on Bale's arm, and turned to confront the one following them. A warder, she assumed from descriptions. The warder stalked up to them. They were still near the perimeter of the camp, the tents organized in rings. She had noticed with discomfort that some of the tents glowed with a light too steady to come from candle or lamp. "Oh," Bale said, raising a friendly hand to the warder. "We do be seeking an Aes Sedai named Nynaeve Almira. If she is not here, perhaps one named Elaine Trakand?" "Neither makes their camp here," the warder said. He was a long-armed man, and he moved with grace. His features, framed by long dark hair, looked unfinished. Chiseled from rock, by a sculptor who had lost interest in the project partway through. "Ah," Bale said. "That do be our mistake, then. Could you point us to where they do be making camp? It do be a matter of some urgency, you see."
He spoke smoothly, easily. Bale could be quite charming when necessary, much more so than Lyalwyn could.
"That depends," the warder said. "Your companion, she wishes to find these Aes Sedai too?"
"She do," Bale began, but the warder held up a hand.
"I would hear it from her," he said, inspecting Lyalwyn.
"It do be what I wish," Lyalwyn said. "My aged grandmother. These women, they did promise us payment, and I do mean to have it. I said I do not lie. Everyone do know this fact. If you will not take us to them, then provide someone who will." The warder hesitated, eyes widening at the barrage of words. Then blessedly he nodded.
"This way."
He led them away from the center of the camp, but he no longer seemed suspicious. Lyalwyn let out a quiet breath and fell into step with Bale behind the warder. Bale looked at her proudly, grinning so widely he'd certainly have given the two of them away if the warder had turned. She couldn't help a hint of a smile herself. The Ilioner accent had not come naturally to her, but both had agreed that her Seanchan tongue was dangerous, particularly when traveling among Aes Sedai. Bale claimed that no true Ilioner would accept her as one of them, but she was clearly good enough to fool an outsider. She felt relieved when they moved away from the Aes Sedai camp into the dark. Having two friends, they were friends, despite their troubles with one another, who were Aes Sedai did not mean she wanted to be inside a camp full of them. The warder led them to an open area near the middle of the field of Merilor. There was a very large camp here, with a great number of small tents.
"Aiel," Bale said softly to her. "There do be tens of thousands of them."
Interesting. Fearsome stories were told of Aiel. Legends that could not all possibly be true. Still, the tales, if exaggerated, suggested that these were the finest warriors this side of the ocean. She would have welcomed sparring with one or two of them, had the situation been different. She rested a hand on the side of her pack. She'd stowed her cudgel in a long pocket on the side, easily within reach. They certainly were a tall folk, these Aiel. She passed some of them lounging by campfires, seemingly relaxed. Those eyes, however, watched more keenly than the warders had. A dangerous people, ready for killing while relaxing beside fires. She could not make out the banners that flapped above this camp in the night sky. "Which king or queen do rule this camp, warder?" she called. The man turned to her, his features lost in the night shadow.
"Your king, Ileana."
At her side, Bale stiffened. "My... the dragon reborn." She was proud that she didn't miss a step as they walked, but it was a near thing. A man who could channel. That was worse, far worse, than the Aes Sedai. The warder led them to a tent near the center of the camp.
"You are fortunate. Her light is on."
There were no guards at the tent entrance, so he called in and received permission to enter. He pulled back the flap with one arm and nodded to them, yet his other hand was on his sword, and he stood in fighting posture. She hated putting that sword to her back, but she entered as ordered. The tent was lit by one of those unnatural globes of light, and a familiar woman in a green dress sat at a writing desk, working on a letter. Nynaeve Almira was what back in Seanchan one would call a Talarti, a woman with fire in her soul. Lyalwyn had come to understand that Aes Sedai were supposed to be calm as placid waters. Well, this woman might be that on occasion, but she was the kind of placid water found one bend away from a furious waterfall. Nynaeve continued to write as they entered. She no longer wore a braid. Her hair was loose around the tops of her shoulders. It was a sight as strange as a ship with no mast. "I'll be with you in a moment, Sleet," Nynaeve said. "Honestly, the way you lot have been hovering over me lately makes me think of a mother bird who has lost an egg. Don't your Aes Sedai have work for you to do?"
"Lan is important to many of us, Nynaeve Sedai,"
the warder Sleet said in a calm, gravelly voice. "Oh, and he's not important to me? Honestly, I wonder if we should send you out to chop wood or something. If one more warder comes to see if I need—" She glanced up, finally seeing Lyalwyn. Nynaeve's face immediately grew impassive, cold, burningly cold. Lyalwyn found herself sweating. This woman held her life in her hands. Why couldn't it have been Elaine that Sleet had brought them to? Perhaps they shouldn't have mentioned Nynaeve.
"These two demanded to see you," Sleet said.
His sword was out of its sheath. Lyalwyn hadn't seen that. Domon muttered softly to himself.
"They claim that you promised to pay them money, and they have come for it. They did not identify themselves in the tower, however, and found a way to slip through one of the gateways. The man is from Ilion. The woman, somewhere else. She's disguising her accent."
Well, perhaps she wasn't as good with the accent as she'd assumed. Lyalwyn glanced at his sword. If she rolled to the side, he'd probably miss a strike, assuming he went for the chest or neck. She could pull the cudgel and... She was facing an Aes Sedai. She'd never stand up from that role. She'd be caught in a weave of the One Power, or worse. She turned to look at Nynaeve.
"I know them, Sleet," Nynaeve said, voice cool. "You did well in bringing them to me." "Thank you."
His sword was sheathed at once, and Lyalwyn felt cool air on her neck as he slipped out of the tent. Quiet as a whisper.
"If you've come to beg forgiveness," Nynaeve said, "you've come to the wrong person. I've half a mind to give you over to the warders to question. Maybe they can bleed something useful about your people from that treacherous mind of yours."
"It is good to see you again too, Nynaeve," Lyalwyn said coolly.
"So what happened?" Nynaeve demanded. "What happened? What was the woman talking about?"
"I did try," Bale suddenly said, regretfully. "I did fight them, but I was taken easily. They could have fired my ship, sunk us all, killed my men."
"Better that you and all aboard should have died, Ileana," Nynaeve said. "The Turangreal ended up in the hands of one of the Forsaken. Semirag was hiding among the Seanchan pretending to be some kind of judge. A truth speaker? Is that the word?
Yes,
Lyle Wynn said softly. She understood now.
I regret breaking my oath, but...
You regret it, Aginan? Nynaeve said, standing, knocking her chair back. Regret is not a word I would use for endangering the world itself, bringing us to the brink of darkness and all but shoving us over the edge. She had copies of that device made, woman. One ended up around the neck of the Dragon Reborn. The Dragon Reborn himself, controlled by one of the Forsaken.
Nynaeve flung her hands into the air.
Light! We were heartbeats from the end, because of you. The end of everything. No more pattern, no more world, nothing. Millions of lives could have winked out because of your carelessness.
I...
Lylwyn's failure seemed monumental suddenly. Her life lost. Her very name lost. Her ship, stripped from her by the Daughter of the Nine Moons herself. All were immaterial in light of this.
I did fight,
Vale said more firmly.
I did fight with what I could give.
I should have joined you, it appears, Lyle Wynn said.
I did try to explain that,
Vale said grimly.
Many times now, burn me, but I did.
Bah, Nynaeve said, raising a hand to her forehead. What are you doing here, Aginan? I had hoped you were dead. If you had died trying to keep your oath, then I could not have blamed you.
I handed it to Suroth myself, Lyle Wynn thought. A price paid for my life, the only way out.
Well? Nynaeve glared at her. Out with it, Aginan.
I no longer bear that name.
Lyle Wynn went down on her knees.
I have had all stripped from me, including my honor, it now appears. I give myself to you as payment.
Nynaeve snorted. We don't keep people as if they were animals, unlike you, Seanchan.
Lylwyn continued kneeling. Vale rested a hand on her shoulder, but did not try to pull her to her feet. He understood well enough now why she had to do as she had. He was quite nearly civilized.
On your feet, Nynaeve snapped. Light, Aginan. I remember you being so strong you could chew rocks and spit out sand.
It is my strength that compels me, she said, lowering her eyes.
Did Nynaeve not understand how difficult this was? It would be easier to slit her own throat. Only she had not the honor left to demand such an easy end.
Stand.
Lylwyn did as told. Nynaeve grabbed her cloak off the bed and threw it on.
Come. We'll take you to the Ammerlin. Maybe she'll know what to do with you.
Nynaeve barged out into the night, and Lylwyn followed. Her decision had been made. There was only one path that made sense, one way to preserve a shred of honor, and perhaps to help her people survive the lies they had been telling themselves for so long. Lylwyn shipless now belonged to the White Tower. Whatever they said, whatever they tried to do with her, that fact would not change. They owned her. She would be a Dako Vale to this Ammerlin, and would ride this storm like a ship whose sail had been shredded by the wind. Perhaps with what remained of her honor, she could earn this woman's trust.
It's part of an old Borderlander relief for the pain, Milton said, removing the bandage at Talmanis's side. The blister leaf slows the taint left by the cursed metal. Milton was a lean, mop-haired man. He was dressed like an Andoran woodsman with a simple shirt and cloak, but he spoke like a Borderlander. In his pouch he carried a set of colored balls that he'd sometimes juggle for the other members of the band. In another life, he must have been a gleeman. He was an unlikely man to be in the band, but they all were, in one way or another.
I don't know how it dampens the poison,
Melton said, but it does. It's no natural poison, mind you. You can't suck it free.
Talmanis pressed his hand to the side. The burning pain felt like thorny vines crawling in under his skin, creeping forward and tearing at his flesh with every movement. He could feel the poison moving through his body. Light, but it hurt. Nearby, the men of the band fought through Camlin up toward the palace. They'd come in through the southern gate, leaving the mercenary bands, under Sandeep's command, holding the western gate. If there was human resistance anywhere in the city, it would be at the palace. Unfortunately, fists of Trollocs roved the area between Talmanis's position and the palace. They kept running across the monsters and getting drawn into fights. Talmanis couldn't find out if, indeed, there was resistance above without getting there. That meant leading his men up toward the palace, fighting all the way, and leaving himself open to being cut off from behind if one of those roving groups worked around behind him. There was nothing for it, though. He needed to find out what, if anything, remained of the palace defenses. From there he could strike further into the city and try to get the dragons. The air smelled of smoke and blood. During a brief pause in the fighting, they'd piled dead Trollocs against the right side of the street to make room for passage. There were refugees in this quarter of the city, too, though not a flood of them. A stream, maybe, seeping in from the darkness as Talmanis and the band seized sections of the thoroughfare leading up toward the palace. These refugees never demanded that the band protect their goods or rescue their homes. They sobbed with joy at finding human resistance. Madwin was in charge of sending them toward freedom along the corridor of safety the band had carved free. Talmanis turned up toward the palace, atop the hill, but only barely visible in the night. Though most of the city burned, the palace was not aflame. Its white walls hung in the smoky night like phantoms. No fire. That had to indicate resistance, didn't it? Wouldn't the Trollocs have attacked it as one of their first actions in the city? He'd sent scouts along the street up ahead as he gave his men, and himself, a short breather. Melton finished tying Talmanis's poultice tight.
"Thank you, Melton," Talmanis said, nodding to the man. "I can feel the poultice working already. You said this is part of the cure for the pain. What is the other part?"
Melton unhooked a metal flask from his belt and handed it over.
"Shinarin brandy. Full strength.
It's not a good idea to drink in combat, man."
"Take it," Melton said softly. "Keep the flask and drink it deep, my lord. Or come the next bell, you won't be standing."
Talmanis hesitated, then took the flask and took a long swallow. It burned like the wound. He coughed, then tucked the brandy away.
"I believe you mistook your bottles, Melton. That was something you found in a tanning vat."
Melton snorted.
"And it's said you have no sense of humor, Lord Talmanis."
"I haven't one," Talmanis said. "Stay close with that sword of yours."
Melton nodded, eyes solemn.
"Dreadbane," he whispered.
"What's that?" "Borderlander title. You slew a fade. Dreadbane. It had about 17 bolts in it at the time." "Doesn't matter."
Melton clasped him on the shoulder.
"Dreadbane. When you can't take the pain any longer, make two fists and raise them toward me. I will see the deed done."
Talmanis stood up, unable to suppress a groan. They both understood. The several borderlanders in the band agreed. Wounds taken by a Thakandar blade were unpredictable. Some festered fast, others made men sick. When one went black like Talmanis's, though, that was the worst. Nothing short of finding an Aes Sedai in the next few hours could save him.
"See," Talmanis muttered, "it is a good thing I have no sense of humor. Otherwise, I should think the pattern was playing a joke on me."
"Denel, you have a map handy?"
"Light, but he missed Bannon."
"My lord,"
Denel said, hurrying across the dark street carrying a torch and a hastily drawn map.
He was one of the band's dragon captains. I think we've found a faster way through the streets to where Aludra had the dragons stored.
We're fighting to the palace first, Talmonis said.
My lord, Denil's words came more softly from his wide lips. He was picking at his uniform as if it didn't fit right.
If the shadow reaches those dragons...
I'm well aware of the dangers, Denil, thank you. How fast could you move the things, assuming we reach them? I'm worried about extending ourselves too far, and this city is going up faster than oil-soaked love letters to a High Lord's mistress. I want to get the weapons and leave the city as quickly as possible. I can level an enemy bulwark in a shot or two, my lord, but the dragons do not move quickly. They are attached to carts, so that will help, but they aren't going to be any faster than, say, a line of supply wagons, and they would take time to set up properly and fire.
Then we continue to the palace, Talmanis said.
But
at the palace, he said sternly, we might find women who can channel us a gateway straight to Aludra's warehouse. Besides, if we find the palace guard still fighting, we know we have a friend at our backs. We will retrieve those dragons, but we'll do it smartly.
He noticed Ladwin and Mar hurriedly coming down from above.
There are Trollocs up there,
Mar said, hastening up to Talmanis.
100 strong at least, hunkered down in the street.
Form ranks, men, Talmanis shouted. We push for the palace.
The sweat tent fell completely still. Avienda had anticipated incredulity, perhaps, at her tale. Questions, certainly. Not this painful silence. Though she had not expected it, she did understand it. She had felt it herself after seeing her vision of the Aiel slowly losing Je et To in the future. She had witnessed the death, dishonor, and ruination of her people. At least now she had someone with whom to share that burden. The heated stones in the kettle hissed softly. Someone should pour more water, but none of the room's 6 occupants moved to tend it. The other 5 were all wise ones, naked, as was Avienda, after the manner of sweat tents. Sorelia, Amis, Bear, Milane, and Chimer of the Tomanella Aiel. All stared straight ahead, each alone for the moment with her thoughts. One by one they straightened their backs and sat up, as if accepting a new burden. That comforted Avienda. Not that she'd expected the news to break them. It was still good to see them set their faces toward the danger, instead of away from it.
Sight blinder is too close to the world now, said Milane. The pattern has been twisted somehow. In the dream we still see many things that may or may not happen, but there are too many possibilities. We cannot tell one from another. The fate of our people is unclear to the dreamwalkers, as is the fate of the Karakarn once he spits in Sightblinder's eye on the last day. We do not know the truth of what Avienda saw.
We must test this, Sorelia said, eyes like stone. We must know. Is each woman now shown this vision instead of the other? Or was the experience unique?
Eleanor of the Darine, Amis said. Her training is nearly complete. She will be the next to visit Ruidian. We could ask Haida and Shani to encourage her.
Avienda suppressed a shudder. She understood too well how encouraging the wise ones could be.
That would be well, Bear said, leaning forward. Perhaps this is what happens whenever someone goes through the glass columns a second time. Maybe that is why it is forbidden.
None of them looked at Avienda, but she could feel them considering her. What she had done was forbidden. Speaking of what happened in Ruidian was taboo also. There would be no reprimand. Ruidian had not killed her.
This was what the wheel had spun. Bear continued to stare into the distance. Sweat trickled down the sides of Avienda's face and her breasts. "I do not miss taking baths," she told herself. She was no soft wetlander. Still, a sweat tent wasn't truly necessary on this side of the mountains. There was no bitter cold at night, so the heat of the tent felt stifling, not comforting. And if water was plentiful enough for bathing, no. She set her jaw. "May I speak?" "Don't be foolish, girl," Milane said. The woman was round in the belly, nearly to term. "You're one of us now. No need to ask permission." "Girl?" It would take time for them to see her truly as one of them. But they did make an effort. Nobody ordered her to make tea or to throw water on the kettle. With no apprentice around and no Guy Shine handy, they took turns doing these tasks. "I am less concerned with whether the vision repeats," Avienda said, "than with what I was shown. Will it happen? Can we stop it?" "Ruidian shows two types of vision," Keimer said. She was a younger woman, perhaps less than a decade Avienda's senior, with deep red hair and a long, tanned face. "The first visit is what could be, the second, to the columns, what has happened." "This third vision could be either," Amis said. "The columns always show the past accurately. Why would they not show the future with equal accuracy?" Avienda's heart lurched. "But why?" Bear said softly. "Would the columns show a despair that cannot change?" "No, I refuse to believe it. Ruidian has always shown us what we needed to see. To help us, not destroy us. This vision must have a purpose as well. To encourage us toward greater honor?" "It's unimportant," Cerulea said curtly. "But," Avienda began. "It's unimportant," Cerulea repeated. "If this vision were unchangeable, if our destiny is to fall, as you have spoken, would any of us stop fighting to change it?" The room grew still. Avienda shook her head. "We must treat it as if it can be changed," Cerulea said. "Best not to dwell on your question, Avienda. We must decide what course to take." Avienda found herself nodding. Yes. Yes, you are correct, wise one." "But what do we do?" Keimer asked. "What do we change? For now the last battle must be won." "Almost," Amis said. "I wish for the vision to be unchangeable, for at least it proves we win this fight." "It proves nothing," Cerulea said. "Sightblinder's victory would break the pattern, and so no vision of the future can be sure or trusted. Even with prophecies of what might happen in ages to come, if Sightblinder wins this battle, all will become nothing." "This vision I saw has to do with whatever Rand is planning," Avienda said. They turned to her. "Tomorrow," she said. "From what you've told me, he's preparing for an important revelation." "The Kara Karn has a fondness for dramatic presentations," Bear said, her tone itself fond. "He's like a crocodile who has toiled all night making a nest so that he can sing of it in the morning to all who will listen." Avienda had been surprised to discover the gathering at Merilor. She had found it only by using her bond to Randall Thor to determine where he was. Arriving here to find so many together, the wetlander forces collected, she wondered if this was part of what she'd seen. Was this gathering the start of what would become her vision? "I feel as if I know more than I should," she spoke almost to herself. "You have had a deep glimpse of what the future may hold, Keimer said. It will change you, Avienda. Tomorrow is key, Avienda said. His plan. From what you said, Keimer replied, it sounds as if he intends to ignore the Aiel, his own people. Why would he give boons to everyone else but not to those who are most deserving? Does he seek to insult us? I don't think that is the reason, Avienda said. I think he intends to make demands of those who attend, not grant them gifts. He did mention a price, Bear said. A price he intends to make the others pay. Nobody has been able to pry the secret of this price from him. He went through a gateway to Tyr earlier this evening and returned with something, Milane said. The maidens report it. He keeps his oath to bring them with him now. When we have inquired after his price, he has said that it is something that the Aiel need not worry about. Avienda scowled. He is making men pay him in order to do what we all know he must. Perhaps he has been spending too much time with that minder the sea folk sent him. No, this is well, Amis said. These people demand much of the Karakarn. He has a right to demand something of them in return. They are soft. Perhaps he intends to make them hard. And so he leaves us out, Bear said softly, because he knows that we are already hard. The tent fell silent. Amis, looking troubled, ladled some water onto the kettle's heated stones. It hissed as the steam rose. That is it, Sorilea said. He does not intend to insult us. He intends to do us honor in his own eyes. She shook her head. He should know better. Often, Keimer agreed. The Karakarn gives insult by accident, as if he were a child. We are strong, so his demand, whatever it is, matters not. If it is a price the others can pay, so can we. He would not make these mistakes if he had been trained properly in our ways, Cerulea murmured. Avienda met their eyes evenly. No, she had not trained him as well as he could have been trained, but they knew that Randall Thor was obstinate. Besides, she was their equal now, although she had trouble feeling that way while facing Sorilea's tight-lipped disapproval. Perhaps it was spending so much time with wetlanders like Elaine, but suddenly she did see things as Rand must. To give the Aiel an exemption from his price, if indeed that was what he intended, was an act of honor. If he had made a demand of them with the others, these very wise ones might have taken offense at being lumped with the wetlanders. What was he planning? She saw hints of it in the visions, but increasingly she was certain that the next day would start the Aiel on the road to their doom. She must see that did not happen. This was her first task as a wise one, and would likely be the most important she was ever given. She would not fail. Her task was not just to teach him, Amis said. What I wouldn't give to know that he was safely under the watchful eyes of a good woman. She looked at Avienda, face laden with meaning. He will be mine, Avienda said firmly. But not for you, Amis, or for our people. She was shocked at the strength of that sentiment within her. She was Aiel. Her people meant everything to her. But this choice was not their choice. This choice was hers. Be warned, Avienda, Bear said, laying a hand on her wrist. He has changed since you left. He has grown strong. Avienda frowned. In what way? He has embraced death, Amis said, sounding proud. He may still carry a sword and wear the clothing of a wetlander, but he is ours now, finally and truly. I must see this, Avienda said, standing. I will discover what I can regarding his plans. There is not much time remaining, Keimer warned. One night remains, Avienda said. It will be enough. The others nodded, and Avienda started to dress. Unexpectedly, the others joined her, dressing as well. It appeared that they considered her news important enough that they would be going to share it with the other wise ones, rather than continuing to sit in conference. Avienda was the first to step out into the night. The cool air, away from the sweltering heat of the sweat tent, felt good on her skin. She took a deep breath. Her mind was heavy with fatigue, but sleep would need to wait. The tent flaps rustled behind the other wise ones, Milane and Ami speaking softly to one another as they hastened into the night. Keimer walked purposefully toward the Tominella section of the camp. Perhaps she would speak with her uncle, Han, the Tominella chief. Avienda started to move off herself, but a bony hand took her arm. She glanced over her shoulder to see Bear standing behind her, dressed again in blouse and skirt. Wise one, Avienda said by reflex. Wise one, Bear replied with a smile. Is there something? I would go to Ruidian, Bear said, glancing at the sky. Would you kindly make for me a gateway? You're going through the glass columns. One of us needs to. Despite what Keimer said, Eleanor is not ready, particularly not to see something of this nature. That girl spends half of her days squawking like a buzzard over the last scrap of a rotting carcass. But, oh, don't you start to. You're one of us now, Avienda. But I'm still old enough to have tended your great-mother when she was a child. Bear shook her head. Her white hair almost seemed to glow in the filtered moonlight. I am the best one to go, she continued. Channelers must be preserved for the battle to come. I would not have some child walk into those columns now. I will do it. Now, that gateway? Will you grant my request, or do I need to bully Amis into doing so? Avienda would have liked to see anyone bully Amis into anything. Maybe Soralia could do it. She said nothing, however, and created the proper weave to open a gateway. The thought of another seeing what she'd seen made her stomach twist. What would it mean if Bear returned with the exact same vision? Would that imply the future was more likely? It was that terrible, was it? Bear asked softly. Horrible. It would have made spears weep and stones crumble, Bear. I would rather have danced with Sightblinder himself. Then it is much better that I go than another. It should be the strongest of us who does this. Avienda stopped herself from raising an eyebrow. Bear was as tough as good leather, but the other wise ones weren't exactly flower petals. Bear, Avienda said, a thought occurring to her. Have you ever met a woman named Nakomi? Nakomi. Bear tried the word in her mouth. An ancient name. I have never known anyone who uses it. Why? I met an Aiel woman while traveling to Ruidian, Avienda said. She claimed not to be a wise one, but she had a way about her. She shook her head. The question was merely idle curiosity. Well, we shall know some of the truth of these visions, Bear said, stepping toward the gateway. What if they are true, Bear? Avienda found herself asking. What if there isn't anything we can do? Bear turned. You saw your children, you said. Avienda nodded. She hadn't spoken in detail of that segment of the vision. It had seemed more personal to her. Change one of their names, Bear said. never speak of the name that child was called in the vision, not even to us. Then you shall know. If one thing is different, then others may be different as well. Will be different. This is not our fate, Avienda. It is a path we will avoid together. Avienda found herself nodding. Yes, a simple change, a small change, but full of meaning. Thank you, Bear. The aging wise one nodded to her, then stepped through the gateway, running in the night toward the city ahead.
Talmanis threw his shoulder against a hulking boar-faced Trolloc in crude chain armor. The beast smelled horrid, like smoke, wet fur, and unwashed flesh. It grunted at the force of Talmanis' assault. The things always seemed surprised when he attacked them. Talmanis pulled back, ripping his sword out of the beast's side as it collapsed. He then lunged forward and rammed his sword into its throat, heedless of its ragged fingernails scratching at his legs. Life faded from the beady, too human eyes. Men fought, called, grunted, killed. The street ran up a steep incline toward the palace. Trolloc hordes had entrenched here, holding position and keeping the band from reaching the top. Talmanis sagged against the side of a building. The one next to it was on fire, lighting the street with violent colors and bathing him in heat. Those fires seemed chilly compared to the flaring, horrible pain of his wound. The flare ran down his leg to his foot and was beginning to work its way across his shoulder. Blood and bloody ashes, he thought. What I'd give for another few hours with my pipe and book, alone and peaceful. The people who spoke of glorious death in battle were complete flaming fools. There was nothing glorious about dying in this mess of fire and blood. Give him a quiet death any day. Talmanis pushed himself back up to his feet, drops of sweat falling from his face. Below, Trollocs amassed themselves behind his rear position. They had closed the road behind Talmanis's force, but Talmanis was able to proceed, cutting through the Trollocs ahead. Retreat would be difficult to pull off. As well as this roadway being full of Trollocs, fighting in the city meant that Trollocs could wind through the streets in small groups and attack his flanks as they advanced and later when they retreated.
"Throw everything you've got at them, men,"
he bellowed, hurling himself up the street and into the Trollocs blocking the way up. The palace was quite close now. He caught a goat-faced Trolloc's sword on his shield right before it would have taken off Denil's head. Talmanis tried to shove the beast's weapon back, but light Trollocs were strong. Talmanis barely kept this one from throwing him to the ground as Denil recovered and attacked its thighs, bringing it down. Melton fell in beside Talmanis. The Borderlander was true to his word to stay close, in case Talmanis needed a sword to end his life. The two led the push up the hill. The Trollocs began to give, then rallied, a snarling, roaring heap of dark fur, eyes and weapons in the firelight.
There were so many of them.
Steady,
Talmanis yelled.
For Lord Matt and the Band of the Red Hand.
If Matt were here, he would probably curse a lot, complain as much, then proceed to save them all with some battlefield miracle. Talmanis couldn't reproduce Matt's blend of insanity and inspiration, but his yell did seem to encourage the men. The ranks tightened. Gavid arrayed his 24 crossbowmen, the last Talmanis had with him, atop a building that hadn't burned away. They started driving flight after flight of bolts into the Trollocs. That might have broken human enemies, but not Trollocs. The bolts dropped a few, but not as many as Talmanis would have hoped.
There's another fade back there, Talmanis thought, pushing them forward. Light, I can't fight another. I shouldn't have fought the one I did.
He shouldn't be on his feet. Melton's flask of brandy was gone, long since drained to deaden what it could. His mind was already as fuzzy as he dared allow. He fell in with Denil and Landrade at the front, fighting, concentrating, letting Trolloc blood out onto the cobbles to stream down the hillside. The band gave a good fight of it, but they were outnumbered and exhausted. Down below, another Trolloc fist joined the ones on the street behind him. That was it. He would have to either hit that force behind, turning his back on the one in front, or break his men into smaller units and send them retreating through side streets to regroup at the gate below. Talmanis prepared to give the orders.
"Forward, the White Lion!" voices yelled. "For Andor and the Queen!"
Talmanis spun as men in white and red broke through the Trolloc lines atop the hill. A second force of Andorran pikemen poured out of a side alleyway, coming in behind the Trolloc horde that had just surrounded him. The Trollocs broke before the oncoming pikemen, and in moments the entire mass, like a pus-filled blister, burst, Trollocs scattering in all directions. Talmanis stumbled back. Momentarily he had to prop himself up with his sword as Madwin took command of the counterstrike, and his men killed many of the fleeing Trollocs. A group of officers in bloodied Queen's Guard uniforms rushed down the hillside. They didn't look any better than the band. Gaibon led them.
"Mercenary," he said to Talmanis, "I thank you for showing up."
Talmanis frowned.
"You act as if we saved you. From my perspective, it happened the other way around."
Gaibon grimaced in the firelight.
"You gave us some respite. Those Trollocs were attacking the palace gates. I apologize for taking so long to reach you. We didn't realize at first what had drawn them in this direction."
"Right. The palace still stands?"
"Yes," Gaibon said. "We're full of refugees, though."
"What of channelers?" Talmanis asked, hopeful. "Why haven't the Andorran armies returned with the Queen?"
"Dark friends," Gaibon frowned. "Her Majesty took most of the kinswomen with her. The strongest ones, at least. She left four with enough power to make a gateway together, but the attack. An assassin killed two of them before the other two could stop him. Alone, the two aren't strong enough to send for help. They're using their strength to heal."
"Blood and bloody ashes,"
Talmanis said, though he felt a stab of hope as he said it. Perhaps these women could not make a gateway, but they might be able to heal his wound.
"You should lead the refugees out of the city, Gaibon. My men hold the southern gate."
"Excellent,"
Gaibon said, straightening.
"But you will have to lead the refugees. I must defend the palace."
Talmanis raised an eyebrow at him. He didn't take orders from Gaibon. The band had its own command structure and reported only to the Queen. Matt had made that clear when accepting the contract. Unfortunately, Gaibon didn't take orders from Talmanis either. Talmanis took a deep breath, but then wavered, dizzy. Melton grabbed his arm to keep him from toppling over.
Light, but it hurt.
Couldn't his side just do the decent thing and grow numb?
Blood and bloody ashes. He needed to get to those kinswomen.
Talmanis said hopefully,
"Those two women who can heal?" "I have sent for them already," Gaibon said. "As soon as we saw this force here."
Well, that was something.
"I do mean to stay here," Gaibon warned. "I won't abandon this post."
"Why? The city is lost, man."
"The Queen ordered us to send regular reports through gateways," Gaibon said. "Eventually she's going to wonder why we haven't sent a messenger. She will send a channeler to see why we haven't reported, and that messenger will arrive at the palace's traveling grounds. It—" "My lord!"
a voice called.
"My lord Talmanis!"
Gaibon cut off, and Talmanis turned to find Filger, one of the scouts, scrambling up the bloodied cobbles of the hillside toward him. Filger was a lean man, with thinning hair and a couple of days' worth of scruff, and the sight of him filled Talmanis with dread. Filger was one of those they'd left guarding the city gate below.
"My lord," Filger said, panting, "the Trollocs have taken the city walls. They're packing the ramparts, loosing arrows or spears at anyone who draws too close. Lieutenant Sandeep sent me to bring you word."
"Blood and ashes. What of the gate?"
"We're holding," Filger said. "For now." "Gaibon,"
Talmanis said, turning back.
"Show some mercy, man. Someone needs to defend that gate. Please take the refugees out and reinforce my men. That gate will be our only method of retreat from the city."
"But the Queen's messenger—"
"The Queen will figure out what bloody happened once she thinks to look here. Look about you. Trying to defend the palace is madness. You don't have a city any longer, but a pyre."
Gaibon's face was conflicted, his lips a tight line.
"You know I'm right," Talmanis said, his face twisted in pain. "The best thing you can do is reinforce my men at the southern gate to hold it open for as many refugees as can reach it."
"Perhaps," Gibbon said. "But to let the palace burn?"
"You can make it worth something," Talmanis said. "What if you left some soldiers to fight at the palace? Have them hold off the Trollocs as long as they can. That will draw the Trollocs away from the people escaping out this way. When they can hold no longer, your soldiers can escape the palace grounds on the far side, and hopefully make their way around to the southern gate."
"A good plan," Gibbon said grudgingly.
"I will do as you suggest. But what of you?"
"I have to get to the dragons," Talmanis said. "We can't let them fall to the shadow. They're in a warehouse near the edge of the inner city. The Queen wanted them kept out of sight, away from the mercenary bands outside. I have to find them. If possible, retrieve them. If not, destroy them."
"Very well,"
Gibbon said, turning away, looking frustrated as he accepted the inevitable.
"My men will do as you suggest. Half will lead the refugees out, then help your soldiers hold the southern gate. The other half will hold the palace a little longer, then withdraw. But I'm coming with you."
"Do we really need so many lamps in here?" the Aes Sedai demanded from her stool at the back of the room. It might as well have been a throne. "Think of the oil you're wasting."
"We need the lamps," Andril grunted.
Night rain pelted the window, but he ignored it, trying to focus on the leather he was sewing. It would be a saddle. At the moment, he was working on the girth that would go around the horse's belly. He poked holes into the leather in a double row, letting the work calm him. The stitching chisel he used made diamond-shaped holes. He could use the mallet on them for speed if he wanted, but right now he liked the feel of pressing the holes without it. He picked up his stitch mark wheel, measuring off the locations for the next stitches, then worked another of the holes. You had to line the flat sides of the diamonds toward one another for holes like this, so that when the leather pulled, it didn't pull on the flats. The neat stitches would keep the saddle in good shape over the years. The rows needed to be close enough together to reinforce one another, but not so close that there was danger of them ripping into one another. Staggering the holes helped. Little things. You just had to make sure the little things were done right, and... His fingers slipped, and he punched a hole with the diamond pointing the wrong way. Two of the holes ripped into one another at the motion. He nearly tossed the entire thing across the room in frustration. That was the fifth time tonight.
"Light," he thought, pressing his hands on the table. "What's happened to my self-control?"
He could answer that question with ease, unfortunately.
"The Black Tower is what happened."
He felt like a multi-legged Nachi trapped in a dried-up tidal pool, waiting desperately for the water to return while watching a group of children work their way down the beach with buckets, gathering up everything that looked tasty. He breathed in and out, then picked up the leather. This would be the shoddiest piece he'd done in years, but he would finish it. Leaving something unfinished was nearly as bad as messing up the details.
"Curious," said the Aes Sedai.
Her name was Pivara, of the Red Aja. He could feel her eyes on his back.
A red. Well, common destinations made for unusual shipmates, as the old Tyran saying went. Perhaps he should use the Saldaean proverb instead. If his sword is at your enemy's throat, don't waste time remembering when it was at yours.
"So," Pivara said, "you were telling me about your life prior to coming to the Black Tower?"
"I don't believe that I was,"
Andril said, beginning to sew.
"Why? What did you want to know?"
"I'm simply curious. Were you one of those who came here on his own to be tested? Or were you one of those they found while out hunting?"
He pulled the thread tight.
"I came on my own, as I believe Evan told you yesterday, when you asked him about me."
She said. "I'm being monitored, I see."
He turned toward her, lowering the leather.
Is that something they teach you?
What? Pivara asked innocently.
To twist a conversation about. There you sit, all but accusing me of spying on you, and you were the one interrogating my friends about me.
I want to know what my resources are.
You want to know why a man would choose to come to the Black Tower? To learn to channel the One Power?
She didn't answer. He could see her deciding upon a response that would not run afoul of the three oaths. Speaking with an Aes Sedai was like trying to follow a green snake as it slipped through damp grass.
Yes, she said.
He blinked in surprise.
Yes, I want to know, she continued. We're allies, whether either of us desires it or not. I want to know what kind of person I've slipped into bed with.
She eyed him. Figuratively speaking, of course. He took a deep breath, forcing himself to become calm. He hated talking with Aes Sedai, with them twisting everything about. That, mixed with the tension of the night and the inability to get this saddle right.
He would be calm, like Burnham.
We should practice making a circle, Pivara said. It will be an advantage to us, albeit a small one against Taim's men, should they come for us. Andral put his dislike of the woman from his mind. He had other things to worry about, and forced himself to think objectively.
A circle.
Do you not know what one is?
Afraid not.
She pursed her lips.
Sometimes I forget how ignorant all of you are.
She paused, as if realizing she'd said too much.
All men are ignorant, Aes Sedai, Andral said. The topics of our ignorance may change, but the nature of the world is that no man may know everything.
That didn't seem to be the answer she'd been expecting either. Those hard eyes studied him. She didn't like men who could channel. Most people didn't. But with her it was more. She had spent her life hunting down men like Andral.
A circle, Pivara said, is created when women and men join their strength in the One Power together. It must be done in a specific way. The Mahale will know about it then.
Men require women to form a circle, Pivara said. In fact, a circle must contain more women than men except in very limited cases.
One woman and man can link, as can one woman and two men, as can two women and two men.
So the largest we could create is a circle of three, with me and two of you. Still, it could be of use to us.
I'll find you two of the others to practice with, Andral said. Among those I trust, I'd say that Nalam is the strongest. Emaran is very powerful, too, and I don't think he's yet reached the height of his strength. Same for Jonath.
They are the strongest? Pivara asked. Not yourself?
No, he said, returning to his work.
That rain picked up again outside, and chill air slipped under the door. One of the room's lamps was burning low nearby, letting shadows into the room. He watched the darkness uncomfortably.
I find that hard to believe, Master Andral, she said. They all look to you. Believe what you wish, Aes Sedai. I'm weakest among them. Perhaps the weakest man in the Black Tower.
This quieted her, and Andral rose to refill that dwindling lamp. As he sat back down, a rap on the door announced the entrance of Emaran and Canler. Although both were wet from the rain, they were nearly as opposite as men could be. One was tall, refined, and careful, the other crotchety and prone to gossip. They had found common ground somewhere and seemed to enjoy one another's company.
Well? Andral asked.
It might work, Emaran said, taking off his rain-soaked coat and hanging it on a hook beside the door. He wore clothing underneath embroidered after the Tyran style.
It would need to be a powerful rainstorm. The guards watch carefully.
I feel like the prize bull at a fair,
Candler grumbled, stomping some of the mud off his boots after hanging up his coat.
Everywhere we go, Taim's favored watch us from the corners of their eyes. Blood and ashes, Andril. They know. They know we're going to try running.
Did you find any weak points? Pivara asked, leaning forward. Someplace where the walls are less well guarded?
It appears to depend upon the guards chosen, Pivara Sedai, Imaran said, nodding to her.
I suppose that it would. Have I mentioned how intriguing I find it that the one of you who treats me with the most respect is a tyrant?
Being polite to a person is not a sign of respect for them, Pivara Sedai, Imaran said. It is merely a sign of a good upbringing and a balanced nature.
Andril smiled. Imaran was an absolute wonder with insults. Half the time the person didn't figure out that he'd been mocked until they'd parted ways. Pivara's mouth pursed.
Well, then, we watch the rotation of guards.
When the next storm arrives, we will use it as cover and escape over the wall near the guards we think are less observant. The two men turned to Andril, who caught himself watching the corner of the room where the shadow fell from a table. Was it growing larger? Reaching toward him.
I don't like leaving men behind,
he said, forcing himself to look away from the corner.
There are dozens upon dozens of men and boys here who aren't yet under Taim's control. We can't possibly lead all of them out without drawing attention. If we leave them, we risk...
He couldn't say it. They didn't know what was happening, not really. People were changing. Once trustworthy allies became enemies overnight. They looked like the same people, yet different at the same time. Different behind the eyes. Andril shivered.
The women sent by the rebel Aes Sedai are still outside the gates, Pivara said.
They had been camped out there for a time, claiming the dragon reborn had promised them warders. Taim had yet to let any of them in.
If we can reach them, we can storm the tower and rescue those left behind. Will it really be that easy?
Imaran asked.
Taim will have an entire village of hostages. A lot of the men brought their families.
Candler nodded. His family was one of those. He wouldn't willingly leave them.
Beyond that,
Andril said softly, turning on his stool to face Pivara.
Do you honestly think the Aes Sedai can win here?
Many of them have decades, some centuries, of experience.
How much of that was spent fighting?
Pivara did not answer.
There are hundreds of men who can channel in here, Aes Sedai,
Andril continued.
Each one has been trained at length to be a weapon. We don't learn about politics or history. We don't study how to influence nations. We learn to kill. Every man and boy here is pushed to the edges of his capacity, forced to stretch and grow, gain more power, destroy. And a lot of them are insane. Can your Aes Sedai fight that? Particularly when many of the men we trust, the very men we're trying to save, will likely fight alongside Taim's men if they see the Aes Sedai trying to invade?
Your arguments are not without merit, Pivara said.
Just like a queen, he thought, unwillingly impressed at her poise.
But surely we need to send information out, Pivara continued. An all-out assault may be unwise, but sitting here until we are all taken, one at a time... I do believe it would be wise to send someone, Imaran said. We need to warn the Lord Dragon.
The Lord Dragon,
Candler said with a snort, taking a seat by the wall.
He's abandoned us, Imaran. We're nothing to him. It...
The Dragon Reborn carries the world on his shoulders, Candler,
Andril said softly, catching Candler up short.
I don't know why he's left us here. But I'd prefer to assume it's because he thinks we can handle ourselves.
Andril fingered the straps of leather, then stood up.
This is our time of proving the test of the Black Tower. If we have to run to the Aes Sedai to protect us from our own, we subject ourselves to their authority. If we have to run to the Lord Dragon, then we will be nothing once he is gone.
There can be no reconciliation with Taim now, Imaren said. We all know what he is doing.
Andril didn't look at Pabara. She had explained what she suspected was happening, and she, despite years of training at keeping her emotions in check, had not been able to quiet the fear in her voice as she spoke of it. 13 Murdral and 13 channelers together in a horrifying rite could turn any channeler to the shadow, against his will.
What he does is pure, undiluted evil, Pivara said. There is no longer a division between the men who follow one leader and those who follow another. This is the Dark One's work, Andril. The Black Tower has fallen under the shadow. You must accept that.
The Black Tower is a dream, he said, meeting her eyes. A shelter for men who can channel. A place of our own, where men need not fear or run or be hated. I will not surrender that to Taim. I will not.
The room fell silent, save for the sounds of rain on the windows. Imaren began to nod, and Candler stood up, taking Andril by the arm.
You're right, Candler said. Burn me if you ain't right, Andril. But what can we do? We're weak, outnumbered.
Imaren, Andril said, did you ever hear about the Nox Rebellion?
Indeed. It caused quite a stir, even outside of Mirandi.
Bloody Mirandians, Candler spat. They'll steal your coat off your back and beat you bloody if you don't offer your shoes, too.
Imaren raised an eyebrow.
Nox was well outside Lugard, Candler, Andril said. I think you'd find the people there not dissimilar to Andorans. The rebellion happened about, 10 years back now.
A group of farmers overthrew their lord, Imaren said. He deserved it, by all accounts. Desartan was a horrid person, particularly to those beneath him. He had a force of soldiers, one of the largest outside of Lugard, and was looking like he'd set up his own little kingdom. There wasn't a thing the king could do about it.
And Desartan was overthrown? Candler asked. By simple men and women who had had too much of his brutality, Andril said. In the end, many of the mercenaries who had been his cronies stood with us. Though he'd seemed so strong, his rotten core led to his downfall. It seems bad here, but most of Taim's men are not loyal to him. Men like him don't inspire loyalty. They'll collect cronies, others who hope to share in the power or wealth. We can and will find a way to overthrow him.
The others nodded, though Pabara simply watched him with pursed lips. Andril couldn't help feeling a bit of the fool. He didn't think the others should be looking to him instead of someone distinguished like Imaren, or someone powerful like Nalam. From the corner of his eye, he saw the shadows underneath the table lengthen, reaching for him. He set his jaw. They wouldn't dare take him with so many people around, would they? If the shadows were going to consume him, they'd wait until he was alone, trying to sleep. Nights terrified him.
They're coming when I don't hold to Sayadin now, he thought. Burn me, the source was cleansed. I'm not supposed to be losing more of my wits.
He gripped the seat of his stool until the terror retreated, the darkness withdrawing. Candler, looking uncharacteristically cheerful, said he was going to fetch them something to drink. He wandered toward the kitchen, but nobody was supposed to go about alone, so he hesitated.
I suppose I could use a drink as well, Pivara said with a sigh, joining him.
Andril sat down to continue his work. As he did, Imaren pulled over a stool, settling down beside him. He did so nonchalantly, as if merely looking for a good place to relax and wanting a view out the window. Imaran, however, wasn't the type to do things without several motivations.
"You fought in the Nox Rebellion?" Imaran said softly.
"Did I say that?"
Andral resumed his work on the leather.
"You said that when the mercenaries switched sides, they fought with you. You used the word us to refer to the rebels."
Andral hesitated.
"Burn me. I really need to watch myself."
If Imaran had noticed, Pivara would have as well.
"I was just passing through," Andral said, "and was caught up in something unanticipated."
"You have a strange and varied past, my friend," Imaran said. "The more I learn of it, the more curious I become."
"I wouldn't say that I'm the only one with an interesting past," Andral said softly. "Lord Elgaron of House Pendalone."
Imaran pulled back, eyes widening.
"How did you know?"
"Fanshir had a book of Tyran noble lines," Andral said, mentioning one of the Ashaman soldiers who had been a scholar before coming to the tower. "It included a curious notation. A house troubled by a history of men with an unmentionable problem, the most recent one having shamed the house not a few dozen years ago."
"I see. Well, I suppose that it is not too much of a surprise that I am a nobleman."
"One who has experience with Aes Sedai," Andral continued, "and who treats them with respect, despite, or because of, what they did for his family. A Tyran nobleman who does this, mind you. One who does not mind serving beneath what you would term farm boys, and who sympathizes with citizen rebels. If I might say, my friend, that is not a prevalent attitude among your countrymen. I wouldn't hesitate to guess you've had an interesting past of your own."
Imaran smiled.
"Point conceded. You would be wonderful at the game of houses, Andral."
"I wouldn't say that," Andral said with a grimace. "Last time I tried my hand at it, I almost..."
He stopped.
"What?"
"I'd rather not say,"
Andral said, face flushing. He was not going to explain that period of his life.
"Light people will think I'm as much a tailspinner as Nalam if I continue on like this."
Imaran turned to watch the rain hitting the window.
"The Nox Rebellion succeeded for only a short time, if I remember correctly. Within 2 years, the noble line had re-established itself, and the dissenters were driven out or executed."
"Yes," Andral said softly.
"So we do a better job of it here," Imaran said, turning to him. "I'm your man, Andral.
We all are."
"No," Andral said.
"We are the Black Tower's men. I'll lead you, if I must. But this isn't about me or about you or any of us individually. I am only in charge until Loghain returns."
"If he ever returns," Andral thought.
"Gateways into the Black Tower don't work any longer. Is he trying to return, but finds himself locked out?"
"Very well," Imaran said. "What do we do?"
Thunder crashed outside.
"Let me think," Andral said, picking up his piece of leather and his tools. "Give me 1 hour."
"I'm sorry,"
Jessamine said softly, kneeling beside Talmanis.
"There is nothing I can do. This wound is too far along for my skill."
Talmanis nodded, replacing the bandage. The skin all along his side had turned black as if from terrible frostbite. The kinswoman frowned at him. She was a youthful-looking woman with golden hair, though with channelers, ages could be very deceptive.
"I'm amazed you can still walk."
"I'm not certain it could be defined as walking,"
Talmanis said, limping back toward the soldiers. He could still gimp along on his own, mostly, but the dizzy moments came more and more frequently now. Gaibon was arguing with Denil, who kept pointing at his map and gesturing. There was such a haze of smoke in the air that many of the men had tied kerchiefs to their faces. They looked like a band of bloody Aiel.
"Even the Trollocs are pulling out of that quarter," Gibbon insisted. "There's too much fire."
"The Trollocs are pulling back to the walls all through the city," Denil replied. "They're going to let the city burn all night. The only sector not burning is the one where the waygate is. They knocked down all of the buildings there to create a firewall."
"They used the One Power," Jessamine said from behind Talmanis. "I felt it. Black Sisters, I would not suggest going in that direction."
Jessamine was the only kinswoman remaining. The other had fallen. Jessamine wasn't powerful enough to create a gateway, but neither was she useless. Talmanis had watched her burn 6 Trollocs that had broken through his line. He'd spent that skirmish sitting back, overcome by the pain. Fortunately, Jessamine had given him some herbs to chew. They made his head feel fuzzier, but made the pain manageable. It felt as if his body were in a vice, being smashed slowly, but at least he could stay on his feet.
"We take the quickest route," Talmanis said. "The quarter that isn't burning is too close to the dragons. I won't risk the Shadow Spawn discovering Aludra and her weapons."
"Assuming they haven't already." Gibbon glared at him, but this was the band's operation. Gibbon was welcome, but he wasn't part of their command structure. Talmanis's force continued through the dark city, wary of ambushes. Though they knew the approximate location of the warehouse, getting there was problematic. Many large streets were blocked by wreckage, fire, or the enemy. His force had to crawl through alleyways and lanes so twisted that even Gibbon and the others from Camelin had difficulty following their intended direction. Their path skirted portions of the city that burned with a heat so strong it was probably melting cobblestones. Talmanis stared at these flames until his eyes felt dry, then led his men in further detours. Inch by inch, they approached Aludra's warehouse. Twice they encountered Trollocs prowling for refugees to kill. They finished these off, the remaining crossbowmen felling over half of each group before they had time to respond. Talmanis stood to watch, but did not trust himself to fight any longer. That wound had left him too weak. Light, why had he left his horse behind? Fool move, that. Well, the Trollocs would have chased it off anyway.
"My thoughts are starting to go in circles."
He pointed with his sword down a crossing alley. The scouts scurried on ahead and looked in both directions before giving the all clear.
"I can barely think. Not much longer now before the darkness takes me."
He would see the dragons protected first. He had to. Talmanis stumbled out of the alley onto a familiar street. They were close. On one side of the street, the structures burned. The statues there looked like poor souls trapped in the flames. The fires raged around them, their white marble slowly becoming overcome with black. The other side of the street was silent, nothing there burning. Shadows thrown by the statues danced and played, like revelers watching their enemies burn. The air smelled oppressively of smoke. Those shadows and the burning statues seemed to move to Talmanis' fuzzy mind. Dancing creatures of shadow, dying beauties consumed by a sickness. Upon the skin, darkening it, feasting upon it, killing the soul.
"We're close now,"
Talmanis said. He pushed himself forward into a shambling run. He couldn't afford to slow them down. If that fire reaches the warehouse. They arrived at a burned-out patch of ground. The fire had been here and gone, apparently. A large wooden warehouse had stood here once, but it had fallen in. Now the timbers only smoldered, and were heaped with rubble and half-burned Trolloc corpses. The men gathered around him silent. The only sound was that of crackling flames. Cold sweat dripped down Talmanis's face.
"We were too late," Melton whispered. "They took them, didn't they? The dragons would have made explosions if they'd burned. The Shadowspawn arrived, took the dragons, and burned the place down."
Around Talmanis, exhausted members of the band sank down to their knees.
I'm sorry, Matt, Talmanis thought. We tried. We...
A sudden sound, like thunder, cracked through the city. It shook Talmanis to his bones, and the men looked up.
Light, Gaibon said. The Shadowspawn are using the dragons?
Maybe not, Talmanis said.
Strength surged through him, and he broke into a run again. His men filled in around him. Each footfall sent a jolt of agony up his side. He passed down the street with the statues, encircled in flames, to his right, cold stillness to his left.
Boom!
Those explosions didn't sound loud enough to be dragons. Dared he hope for an Aes Sedai? Jessamine seemed to have perked up at the sounds and was running in her skirts alongside the men. The group barreled around a corner two streets from the warehouse and came up on the back ranks of a snarling force of Shadowspawn. Talmanis bellowed with a startling ferocity and raised his sword in two hands. The fire of his wound had spread through his entire body. Even his fingers burned with it. He felt as if he'd become one of those statues, consigned to burn with the city. He beheaded a Trolloc before it knew he was there, then threw himself at the next creature in line. It drew back with an almost liquid grace, turning a face on him that had no eyes, a cloak that did not stir in the wind. Pale lips drew back in a snarl. Talmanis found himself laughing. Why not? And men said he didn't have a sense of humor. Talmanis moved into apple blossoms in the wind, striking forward wildly with a strength and fury to match the fire that was killing him. The Myrdral obviously had him at a disadvantage. At his best, Talmanis would have needed help fighting one. The thing moved like a shadow, flowing from one form to the next, its terrible blade darting toward Talmanis. It obviously felt it only needed to nick him. It scored a hit on his cheek, the tip of its sword catching on his skin there and slicing a neat ribbon through the flesh. Talmanis laughed and struck at the weapon with his sword, causing the Fade's mouth to open wide in surprise. That wasn't how men were supposed to react. They were supposed to stumble at the burning flare of pain, cry out as they knew their life had ended.
"I've already had one of your flaming swords in me, you son of a goat!"
Talmanis screamed, attacking time and time again. Blacksmith strikes the blade. Such an inelegant form. It fit his mood perfectly. The Myrdral stumbled. Talmanis swept back in a smooth motion, bringing his sword to the side and slicing the thing's pale white arm free at the elbow. The limb twisted in the air, the Fade's blade dropping from spasming fingers. Talmanis spun for momentum and brought his sword across with two hands, severing the Fade's head from its neck. Dark blood sprayed free and the thing fell, its remaining hand clawing at the bloodied stump as it collapsed. Talmanis stood over it, his sword suddenly feeling too heavy to hold. It slipped from his fingers, clanging to the paving stones. He tipped and lost his balance, falling face first, but a hand caught him from behind.
Light,
Milton exclaimed, looking at the body.
Another one! I've found the secret to defeating them, Talmanis whispered. You just have to be dead already.
He chuckled to himself, though Melton just looked at him, seeming baffled. Around them, dozens of Trollocs collapsed to the ground, writhing. They'd been linked to the Fade. The band gathered around Talmanis, some bearing wounds. A few were down for good. They were exhausted and worn down. This batch of Trollocs could have ended them. Milton retrieved Talmanis's sword and swabbed it clean, but Talmanis found he was having trouble standing, so he sheathed it and had a man fetch a Trolloc spear for him to lean on.
Ho! The back of the street,
a distant voice called.
Whoever you are, thank you.
Talmanis limped forward, Filger and Mar scouting on ahead without needing orders. The street here was dark and cluttered with Trollocs that had fallen moments ago, so it was a moment before Talmanis could climb over the corpses and see who had called to him. Someone had built a barricade at the end of the street. People stood atop it, including one who held aloft a torch. She had hair in braids and wore a plain brown dress with a white apron. It was Aludra.
"Cawthon's soldiers," Aludra said, sounding unimpressed.
"Your time, you certainly did take it in coming for me."
In one hand she held a stubby leather cylinder larger than a man's fist, with a short length of dark fuse attached. Talmanis knew they exploded after she lit and threw them. The band had used them before, hurling them from slings. They weren't as devastating as dragons, but still powerful.
"Aludra," Talmanis called. "You have the dragons? Please tell me you saved them."
She sniffed, waving for some people to pull apart a side of the barricade to admit his men. She appeared to have several hundred, maybe several thousand, townspeople back there, filling the street. As they opened the way for him, he saw a beautiful sight. Surrounded by townspeople, 100 dragons rested there. The bronze tubes had been fitted to wooden dragon carts to comprise a single unit, pulled by 2 horses. They were really quite maneuverable, all things considered. Those carts could be anchored in the ground to manage recoil, Talmanis knew, and the dragons fired once the horses were detached. There were more than enough people here to do the work horses should have been available to do.
"You think I would leave them?"
Aludra asked.
"This lot. They do not have the training to fire them, but they can pull a cart as well as anyone else."
"We have to get them out," Talmanis said.
"This, it is a new revelation to you?" Aludra asked. "As if I haven't been trying to do that very thing. Your face, what is wrong with it?"
"I once ate a rather sharp cheese, and it has never quite sat right with me." Aludra cocked a head at him. Maybe if I smiled more when I made jokes, he thought idly, leaning against the side of the barricade. Then they'd understand what I meant. That, of course, raised the question, did he want people to understand? It was often more amusing the other way. Besides, smiling was so garish. Where was the subtlety? And he was really having trouble focusing. He blinked at Aludra, whose face had grown concerned in the torchlight.
"What about my face?"
Talmanis raised a hand to his cheek. "Blood. The Murdral. Right.
Just a cut. And the veins?"
"Veins?" he asked, then noticed his hand. Tendrils of blackness, like ivy growing beneath the skin, had wound down his wrist and across the back of his hand toward the fingers. They seemed to be growing darker as he watched.
"Oh, that. I'm dying, unfortunately. Terribly tragic.
You wouldn't happen to have any brandy, would you?"
"Aye. My lord!"
a voice called. Talmanis blinked, then forced himself to turn about, leaning on the spear.
"Yes, Filgar?"
"More Trollocs, my lord. Lots of them. They're filling in behind us."
"Lovely. Set the table. I hope we have enough dinnerware. I knew we should have sent the maid for that 5,731st set." "Are you feeling all right?"
Aludra asked.
"Blood and bloody ashes, woman. Do I look like I'm feeling well?"
"Gaibon, retreat is cut off. How far from the east gates are we?"
"East gates?"
Gaibon called.
"Maybe a half-hour march. We need to head further down the hill."
"Onward we go, then," Talmanis said.
"Take the scouts and go on point. Denil, make sure those local folk are organized to haul those dragons. Be ready to set up the weapons."
"Talmanis,"
Aludra said, stepping in.
"Dragon's eggs and powder. We have few of them left. We will need the supplies from Berlon. Today, if you set up the dragons, a few shots for each dragon. This is all I can give you."
Denil nodded.
"Dragons aren't meant to make up frontline units all by themselves, my lord. They need support to keep the enemy from coming too close and destroying the weapons. We can man those dragons, but we won't last long without infantry."
"That's why we're running," Talmanis said. He turned, took a step, and was so woozy he almost fell.
"And I believe I'll need a horse."
Mogadin stepped onto a platform of stone, floating in the middle of an open sea. Glassy and blue, the water rippled in the occasional breeze, but there were no waves. Neither was there land in sight. Moradin stood at the side of the platform, hands clasped behind his back. In front of him, the sea burned. The fire gave off no smoke, but it was hot, and the water near it hissed and boiled. Stone flooring in the middle of an endless sea. Water that burned. Moradin always had enjoyed creating impossibilities within his dream shards. "Sit," Moradin said to her, not turning. She obeyed, choosing one of the four chairs suddenly arranged near the center of the platform. The sky was deep blue, cloudless, and the sun hung at about three-quarters of the way to its zenith. How long had it been since she'd seen the sun in Tel Iranriad? Lately, that omnipresent black storm had blanketed the sky. But then this wasn't completely Tel Iranriad. Nor was it Moradin's dream, but a melding of the two. Like a temporary lean-to built off the side of the dream world. A bubble of merged realities. Mogadine wore a gown of black and gold, lacework on the sleeves faintly reminiscent of a spider's web. Only faintly. One did well not to overuse a theme. As she sat, Mogadine tried to exude control and self-confidence. Once both had come easily for her. Today, trying to capture either was like trying to snatch dandelion seeds from the air, only to have them dance away from her hand. Mogadine gritted her teeth, angry at herself. She was one of the chosen. She had made kings weep, armies tremble. Her name had been used by generations of mothers to frighten their children, and now? She felt at her neck. Found the pendant hanging there. It was still safe. She knew it was, but touching it brought her calmness. "Do not grow too comfortable wearing that," Moradin said. A wind blew across him, rippling the pristine ocean surface. On that wind she heard faint screams. "You are not completely forgiven, Mogadin. This is a probation. Perhaps when you fail next, I will give the mind trap to Demondred." She sniffed. "He would toss it aside in boredom. Demondred wants only one thing. Althor. Anyone who does not lead him toward his goal is unimportant to him." "You underestimate him," Moradin said softly. "The great lord is pleased with Demondred. Very pleased. You, however..." Mogadine sank down in her chair, feeling her tortures anew. Pain, such as few in this world had ever known. Pain beyond what a body should be able to endure. She held to the Cour Suvra and embraced Sidar. That brought some relief. Before, channeling in the same room as the Cour Suvra had been agonizing. Now that she, rather than Moradin, wore the pendant, it was not so. "Not just a pendant," she thought, clutching it. "My soul itself. Darkness within. She had never thought that she, of all people, would find herself subject to one of these. Was she not the spider? Careful in all that she did?" She reached her other hand up, clasping it over the one that held the pendant. What if it fell? What if someone took it? She wouldn't lose it. She couldn't lose it. "This is what I have become." She felt sick. "I have to recover. Somehow." She forced herself to let go of the mind trap. The last battle was upon them. Already Trollocs poured into the southern lands. It was a new war of the shadow, but only she and the other chosen knew the deeper secrets of the One Power. The ones she hadn't been forced to give up to those horrible women. No, don't think about that. The pain, the suffering, the failure. In this war, they faced no 100 companions, no Aes Sedai with centuries of skill and practice. She would prove herself, and past errors would be forgotten. Moradin continued to stare at those impossible flames. The only sounds were that of the fire and of the water that boiled near it. He would eventually explain his purpose in summoning her, wouldn't he? He had been acting increasingly strange lately. Perhaps his madness was returning. Once, the man named Moradin, or Ishamael, or Ilan Morin Tedronai, would have delighted in holding a Cor Suvra for one of his rivals. He would have invented punishments, thrilled in her agony. There had been some of that at the start. Then, he had lost interest. He spent more and more time alone, staring into flames, brooding. The punishments he had administered to her and Sindane had seemed almost routine. She found him more dangerous this way. A gateway split the air just to the side of the platform. "Do we really need to do this every other day, Moradin?" Demondred asked, stepping through and into the world of dreams. Handsome and tall, he had jet hair and a prominent nose. He gave Mugadin a glance, noting the mind trap on her neck before continuing. "I have important things to do, and you interrupt them. There are people you need to meet, Demondred," Moradin said softly. "Unless the Great Lord has named you nameless without informing me, you will do as you are told. Your playthings can wait." Demondred's expression darkened, but he did not object further. He let the gateway close, then turned to the side, looking down into the sea. He frowned. What was in the waters? She hadn't looked. She felt foolish for not having done so. What had happened to her caution? Demondred walked to one of the chairs near her, but did not sit. He stood, contemplating Moradin from behind. What had Demondred been doing? During her period bound to the mind trap, she had done Moradin's bidding, but had never found an answer to Demondred. She shivered again, thinking of those months under his control. "I will have vengeance." "You've let Mugadin free," Demondred said. "What of this Sindane?" "She is not your concern," Moradin said. Mugadin had not failed to notice that Moradin still wore Sindane's mind trap. Sindane. It meant last chance in the old tongue, but the woman's true nature was one secret that Mugadin had discovered. Moradin himself had rescued Lanfear from Sindal, freeing her from the creatures that feasted upon her ability to channel. In order to rescue her, and of course to punish her, Moradin had slain her. That had allowed the Great Lord to recapture her soul and place it in a new body. Brutal, but very effective. Precisely the kind of solution the Great Lord preferred. Moradin was focused on his flames and Demondred on him, so Mugadin used the chance to slip out of her seat and walk to the edge of the floating stone platform. The water below was completely clear. Through it she could see the people very distinctly. They floated with their legs chained to something deep below, arms bound behind them. They swayed like kelp. There were thousands of them. Each of them looked up at the sky with wide, horrified eyes. They were locked in a perpetual state of drowning. Not dead, not allowed to die, but constantly gasping for air and finding only water. As she watched, Something dark reached up from below and pulled one of them down into the depths. Blood rose like a blooming flower. It caused the others to struggle all the more urgently. Mogadine smiled. It did her good to see someone other than herself suffering. These might simply be figments, but it was possible that they were ones who had failed the great lord. Another gateway opened at the side of the platform, and an unfamiliar woman stepped through. The creature had alarmingly unpleasant features, with a hooked yet bulbous nose and pale eyes that were off-center with one another. She wore a dress that tried to be fine, of yellow silk, but it only served to highlight the woman's ugliness. Mogadine sneered and returned to her seat. Why was Moradin admitting a stranger to one of their meetings? This woman could channel. She must be one of those useless women who called themselves Aes Sedai in this age. Granted, Mogadine thought, sitting. She is powerful. How had Mogadine missed noticing one with this talent among the Aes Sedai? Her sources had picked out that wretched light-skirt Nynaeve almost immediately, yet they'd missed this hag?
"This is who you wish us to meet?" Demon Dread said, lips turning down.
"No," Moradin said absently. "You've met Hesalam before." Hesalam. It meant without forgiveness in the old tongue. The woman met Mogadine's eyes proudly, and there was something familiar about her stance.
"I have things to be about, Moradin," the newcomer said. "This had better be—"
Mogadine gasped. The tone in that voice.
"Do not take that tone with me," Moradin cut in, speaking softly, not turning. "Do not take it with any of us. Currently, even Mogadine is favored more than you."
"Grendel?" Mogadine asked, horrified.
"Do not use that name,"
Moradin said, spinning on her, the burning water flaring up.
"It has been stripped from her."
Grendel, Hesalam, sat down without looking again at Mogadine. Yes, the way the woman carried herself was right. It was her. Mogadine almost chortled with glee. Grendel had always used her looks as a bludgeon. Well, now they were a bludgeon of a different type. How perfect. The woman must be positively writhing inside. What had she done to earn such a punishment? Grendel's stature, her authority, the myths told about her, were all linked to her beauty. What now? Would she have to start searching for the most horrid people alive to keep as pets, the only ones who could compete with her ugliness? This time Mogadine did laugh. A quiet laugh, but Grendel heard. The woman shot her a glare that could have set a section of the ocean aflame all on its own. Mogadine returned a calm gaze, feeling more confident now. She resisted the urge to stroke the Cour Souvre. "Bring what you will, Grendel," she thought. "We are on level footing now. We shall see who ends this race ahead." A stronger wind blew past, and ripples started to rise around them, though the platform itself remained secure. Moradin let his fire die out, and nearby, waves rose. Mogadine could make out bodies, little more than dark shadows, inside those waves. Some were dead. Others struggled for the surface, their chains removed, but as they neared the open air, something always towed them back down again.
"We are few now," Moradin said. "We four, and the one who is punished most, are all that remain. By definition, that makes us the strongest."
"Some of us are," Mogadine thought. "One of us was slain by Althor, Moradin, and required the Great Lord's hand to return him. Why had Moradin never been punished for his failure? Well, it was best not to look too long for fairness in the Great Lord's hand.
Still, we are too few.
Moradin waved a hand, and a stone doorway appeared on the side of the platform. Not a gateway, just a door. This was Moradin's dream shard. He could control it. The door opened, and a man strode through it and out onto the platform. Dark-haired, the man had the features of a Saldaean, a nose that was faintly hooked, eyes that tilted. He was handsome and tall, and Mogadine recognized him. The leader of those fledgling male Aes Sedai? I know this man. Masri...
That name has been discarded, Moradin said. Just as each of us upon being chosen discarded what we were and the names men called us. From this moment on, this man shall be known only as Mihail, one of the chosen.
Chosen? Esalam seemed to choke on the word. This child? He... She cut off. It was not their place to debate if one was chosen. They could argue among themselves, even plot, if they did so with care. But questioning the Great Lord, that was not allowed. Ever. Hesalam said no more. Moradin would not dare call this man chosen if the Great Lord had not decided it. There was no argument to be made. Still, Mogadin shivered. Taim, Mihail, was said to be strong, perhaps as strong as the rest of them. But elevating one from this age with all of their ignorance, it galled her to consider that this Mihail would be regarded as her equal.
I see the challenge in your eyes, Moradin said, looking at the three of them, though only one of you was foolish enough to start voicing it. Mihail has earned his reward. Too many of our number threw themselves into contests with Al-Thor when he was presumed to be weak. Mihail instead earned Luz Theron's trust, then took charge of the training of his weapons. He has been raising a new generation of dreadlords to the Shadow's cause. What did the three of you have to show for your work since being released?
You will know the fruits I have harvested, Moradin,
Demondred said, voice low.
You will know them in bushels and droves. Just remember my requirement. I face Al-Thor on the field of battle. His blood is mine, and no one else's.
He turned to meet their eyes, each in turn, then finally those of Mihail. There seemed to be a familiarity to them. The two had met before. You will have competition with that one, Demondred, Mogadin thought. He wants Al-Thor nearly as much as you do. Demondred had been changing lately. Once, he wouldn't have cared who killed Luz Theron, so long as the man died. What made Demondred insist on doing the deed himself?
Mogadin, Moradin said. Demondred has plans for the war to come. You are to assist him.
Assist him? She said. I...
Do you forget yourself so quickly, Mogadin?
Moradin's voice was silky.
You will do as you are told. Demondred wants you watching over one of the armies that now lacks proper monitoring. Speak a single word of complaint, and you will realize that the pain you have known up to now is but a shadow of true agony.
Her hand went to the Corsouvre at her neck. Looking into his eyes, she felt her authority evaporate. I hate you, she thought. I hate you more for doing this to me in front of the others.
The last days are upon us,
Moradin said, turning his back on them.
In these hours you will earn your final rewards.
If you have grudges, put them behind you. If you have plots, bring them to completion. Make your final plays, for this is the end.
Talmanis lay on his back, staring up at a dark sky. The clouds above seemed to be reflecting light from below, the light of a dying city. That was wrong. Light came from above, didn't it? He'd fallen from the horse not long after starting for the city gate. He could remember that, most of the time. Pain made it hard to think. People yelled at one another.
I should have taunted Matt more, he thought, a hint of a smile cracking his lips. Stupid time to be thinking of such things. I have to find the dragons. Or did we find them already?
I'm telling you, the bloody things don't work like that.
Denil's voice.
They're not bloody Aes Sedai on wheels. We can't make a wall of fire. We can send these balls of metal hurtling through the Trollocs. They explode, Gaibon's voice. We could use the extras like I say.
Talmanis's eyes drifted closed.
The balls explode, yes, Denil said. But we have to launch them first. Setting them all in a row and letting the Trollocs run over them won't do much.
A hand shook Talmanis's shoulder.
Lord Talmanis, Melton said, there is no dishonor in letting it end now. I know the pain is great. May the last embrace of the mother shelter you.
A sword being drawn, Talmanis steeled himself. Then he found that he really, really didn't want to die. He forced his eyes open and held up a hand to Melton, who stood over him. Jessamine hovered nearby with arms folded, looking worried.
Help me to my feet, Talmanis said.
Melton hesitated, then did so.
You shouldn't be standing, Jessamine said.
Better than being beheaded in honor,
Talmanis grumbled, gritting his teeth against the pain.
Light, was that his hand? It was so dark. It looked as if it had been charred in a fire. What is going on?
We're cornered, my lord, Melton said grimly, eyes solemn. He thought them all as good as dead. Denil and Gaibon are arguing over placement of the dragons for a last stand. Eludra is measuring the charges.
Talmanis, finally standing, sagged against Melton. Before him, 2,000 people clustered in the center of a large city square. They huddled like men in the wilderness, seeking one another's warmth on a cold night. Denil and Gaibon had set up the dragons in a half-circle, bowed outward, pointing toward the center of the city, refugees behind. The band was now committed to manning the dragons. Three pairs of hands were needed to operate each weapon. Almost all of the band had had at least some training. The buildings nearby had caught fire, but the light was doing strange things. Why didn't it reach the streets? Those were all too dark. As if they'd been painted. Like... He blinked, clearing the tears of pain from his eyes, realization dawning. Trollocs filled the streets like ink flowing toward the half-circle of dragons that were pointed at them. Something held the Trollocs back for the moment.
They're waiting until they are all together for a rush, Talmanis thought.
Calls and snarls came from behind. Talmanis turned, then clutched Melton's arm as the world lurched. He waited for it to steady. The pain was actually dulling, like glowing flames running out of fresh coal. It had feasted upon him, but there wasn't much left of him for it to eat. As things steadied, Talmanis saw what was creating the snarls. The square they were in adjoined the city wall, but the townspeople and soldiers had kept their distance from the wall, for it was coated with Trollocs like a thick grime. They raised weapons in the air and roared down at the people.
They throw down spears at anyone who comes too close, Melton said. We'd been hoping to reach the wall, then follow it along to the gate, but we can't. Not with those things up there raining death upon us. All other routes are cut off.
Eludra approached Gaibon and Denil.
"Charges I can set under the dragons," she said to them, softly, but not as softly as she should have. "These charges, they will destroy the weapons. They may hurt the people in an unpleasant way." "Do it," Gibbon said very softly. "What the Trollocs would do is worse, and we cannot allow the dragons to fall into the Shadow's hands. That's why they are waiting. Their leaders are hoping that a sudden rush will give them time to overwhelm us and seize the weapons."
"They're moving,"
a soldier called from beside the dragons.
"Light, they're coming!"
That dark slime of shadow spawn bubbled down the streets. Teeth, nails, claws, two human eyes. The Trollocs came from all sides, eager for the kill. Talmanis struggled to draw breath. On the walls, the calls grew excited. "We're surrounded," Talmanis thought. "Pressed back against the wall, caught in a net, we..." Pressed back against the wall.
"Dunnel!"
Talmanis shouted over the din. The captain of the dragons turned from his line, where men waited with burning punks for the call to launch the one volley they'd have. Talmanis took a deep breath that made his lungs burn.
"You told me that you could level an enemy bulwark in only a few shots." "Of course,"
Dennel called.
"But we're not trying to enter."
He trailed off. "Light," Talmanis thought. "We're all so exhausted, we should have seen this."
"You, in the middle, Raiden's dragon squad. About face,"
Talmanis screamed.
"The rest of you, stay in position and fire at the oncoming Trollocs. Move, move, move!"
The dragoners sprang into motion, Raiden and his men hastily turning their weapons about, wheels creaking. The other dragons began to fire a pattern of shot that sprayed across the entire square. The booms were deafening, causing refugees to scream and cover their ears. It sounded like the end of the world. Hundreds, thousands of Trollocs went down in pools of blood as dragons' eggs exploded in their midst. The square filled with white smoke that poured from the mouths of the dragons. The refugees behind, already terrified by what they had just witnessed, shrieked as Raiden's dragons turned on them, and most of them fell to the ground in fright, clearing a path. A path that exposed the Trolloc-infested city wall. Raiden's line of dragons bowed inward like a cup, the reverse formation of those firing into the Trollocs behind, so that the tubes were pointed at the same section of city wall.
"Give me one of those bloody punks,"
Talmanis shouted, holding out a hand. One of the dragoners obeyed, passing him a flaming brand with a glowing red tip. He pushed away from Melton, determined to stand on his own for the moment. Gibbon stepped up. The man's voice sounded soft to Talmanis' strained ears.
"Those walls have stood for hundreds of years. My poor city. My poor, poor city."
"It's not your city any longer," Talmanis said, raising his flaming brand high in the air, defiant before a wall thick with Trollocs, a burning city to his back. "It's theirs."
Talmanis swiped the brand down in the air, leaving a trail of red. His signal ignited a roar of dragon fire that echoed throughout the square. Trollocs, pieces of them at least, blew into the air. The wall under them exploded like a stack of children's blocks kicked at a full run. As Talmanis wavered, his vision blackening, he saw the wall crumble outward around the hole. When he toppled, slipping into unconsciousness, the ground seemed to tremble from the force of his fall.